I will call the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices to order. Welcome, everyone. We do have a quorum present. Representative Vogel would like to move the minutes from March 5th, 2015. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of March 5th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. The first item on the agenda is House File 518. And I will go to the testifiers table for that. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Scott.
It appears that I left my family law file upstairs on my desk, so I'll try to wing it from here. House File 518, actually, yeah, maybe I will just take that folder. I can wing it. Okay, House File 518 is a bill that we have heard in the committee before, and we did lay it over. Now we'd like to go ahead and move it forward. So I'd like to move House File 518, and I believe it's—is it going to the General Register or to Public Safety?
Public Safety.
Okay, I'd like to move that bill be re-referred to Public, the Committee on Public Safety. And just as a reminder to folks on the committee, this file or this bill. Is a product of our custody dialogue group. This particular bill clarifies the parenting time of a 25% minimum presumption. And that law came into effect about 8 years ago. And since that time, it seems that that has been the 25% has been used in many courts as a floor and not a ceiling. And so we just, if you take an analogy of speed limit on a freeway, the minimum being 45 miles an hour, very few people are going to actually drive 45 miles an hour because that is the minimum. So we want to just to make a little tweak in the language that clarifies that the 25% is to be seen as a floor. Actually, let me back that up, that it was seen as a ceiling and not a floor. So that is a minimum. So we tweak that language to a minimum of 25%. The next section of the bill talks about compensatory time, parenting time, when one parent has been denied parenting time by the other, the court-ordered parenting time. And it also establishes there towards the end of that section civil penalties for continued, the language is repeatedly and intentionally denying court-ordered parenting time. So there are some civil penalties there. The next section basically says that in a post-decree stipulation, parties can reach an agreement on their own, a private agreement. And the next section, Section 4, talks about providing income information. And if this just says if one party is supposed to give the other party a copy of the income tax return and they don't have the return finished or they haven't filed, that they do have to give the supporting documents to that tax return to the other party. So a party's 1099, W-2, K-1, those sorts of things would have to be supplied. Um, So I believe that is encompasses the bill. Actually, I got the one out of order that talks about the alternative. Oh, actually, no, I didn't. The alternative effective date is the last section of the bill. That normally when you're going into court for, I believe this applies to modification only, is that right? Yes, okay, so only when they're going back in for modification. Normally the date that the papers are filed is the effective date, but this is just saying that the parties can agree to a binding agreement of a different effective date. And with that, that's the summary of the bill, and so I would just take any questions that members might have.
Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, I see that in the remedy section, you are giving a remedy for when one parent withholds the child from another. What's the remedy when one parent continues to not show up to pick up the child when it's their date and time, and at the last second, the parent who has primary time ends up having to find alternative plans or ends up having to arrange for childcare or ends up having to put out additional dollars based on the failure of that parent to actually comply with the parenting time schedule?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. I believe that's already in current law, but I'll let Mr. Detmer answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Please state your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Michael Detmer. I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. Representative Hillstrom, I have practiced family law for 30 years. Generally, when I'm faced with that type of situation, as are many of my colleagues, we'll try to address that through seeking relief from the court to, I guess, sometimes have financial sanctions against an individual who places somebody in that predicament, who has to make alternative arrangements for child care because somebody chose not to exercise the parenting time. We didn't include that in this particular bill as an item of relief, but this bill, I believe, is fair to both custodial parents and non-custodial parents, to fathers and mothers, of whether they're custodial or non-custodial, because it I think it not only does it provide additional enforcement remedies for denials of compensatory parenting time, but it also takes into consideration the impact on the children and whether or not there might be a defense to a request for compensatory time and other sanctions in the event that it is believed that parenting time would not be in a child's physical or emotional health. So we had a broad-based group of people that were working on this. We haven't dealt with that particular issue in this legislation, but I really don't think that there was as much of a need perceived by all the different stakeholders that were involved in our group to have specific legislative provision regarding that issue and addressing it.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Scott, I understand that this is part of a working group process and you all came to some consensus around some of these issues, but I think if you're putting penalties in, you should be putting penalties in for both sides of the bad behavior. I don't think you should be saying it's not okay if you withhold, but it is okay if you fail to show up when it's your time. Because if you have someone who continues to fail to show up, and then the one time the parent denies, they're being brought in for penalties and remedies, right? It's just another way to continue to bring somebody back to court, back to court, back to court. And you ought to be able to have the ability to balance both sets of bad behavior.
Representative Scott.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Hillstrom, and I'll certainly take that under advisement. Again, it didn't even come up in our group, so I'm not sure that that's something that we can address this year, but in the ensuing years, it doesn't seem like it would be a problem to talk about that.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Scott renews her motion to have House File 518 be re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say nay. The ayes have it. House File 518 is re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. On to House File 497.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if there's somebody from the counties here to testify on this. House File 497 was brought to me by the folks at Anoka County. Several counties have come to the table on this, and they just want to make some clarifications as far as income withholdings when it applies to back arrears child support. And so I'll let the testifier explain it in further.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, Chairman. My name is Ward Ines. I'm here on behalf of Anoka County. And I think Chair Scott accurately portrayed the bill. Basically, right now we have a conflict in the child support arrears area if there's a court order and the statute. The statute requires us to withhold 20% of the outstanding obligation that's owed. But if we have a court order that contradicts that amount, we have to put the court order into the system, and then we have to add the 20% onto that amount. The system requires that. So this would allow us to not do it. Then we have to do a manual workaround, essentially. And every county has a different process for doing this manual workaround. So really, this is about efficiencies, making sure when we have a conflict between a court order and the statute, which requires 20%, we can just do the court order, plug that into the system, and not have to do a manual workaround in order to get the appropriate amount to the child support, person who's owed the child support. And this is supported by the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. It's also been endorsed by the Minnesota Family Support and Recovery Council.
Any questions? Comments? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you believe that taking this 20% out of the statute then will result in the majority of orders then being less than 20% going forward?
Mr. Ines.
Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, in fact, we're not going to take the 20% out of the statute. What it will do is that when there is, in fact, a court order, the court order is the amount that will be. So in all other instances, when there's not a court order, it would be at 20% still. So it's only when there's a conflict between the 20% that's in current statute and a court order that's issued.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it doesn't impact the judge's ability to go over the 20%.
Mr. Ines.
Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, exactly, precisely. That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if the court order is for 40%, but the statute says 20%, does the person who's been ordered to pay the 40% have the ability to say, well, wait a minute, the statute only says 20%?
Mr. Ines.
Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, it's a very good question. And the court order will always trump the 20% in the statute. So that's, yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Scott renews her motion to have House File 497 be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. The ayes have it. 497 is sent to the General Register. On to House File 155. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 155 is my bill on license plate readers. It basically says that unless there is a hit on the license plate reader, that the data would not be kept; it would be destroyed. With that, I would guess I would take questions. There are some requirements in there for law enforcement to maintain a log of its use. For things such as location, locations where the reader is installed or used, specific times of day that the reader actively collected the data, and aggregate number of vehicles or license plates on which the data are collected for each period of active use. I'm guessing since this is the third time we've heard this bill, that members are fairly familiar with how it works.
And Representative Scott, let me start by saying that I move to have House File 155 brought before the committee, and also I move that your bill, House File 155, be re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd ask for a roll call vote on this bill.
All right, and before that is noted, Representative Hillstrom, before we get to that, there are some testifiers. If there's any testifiers, would they please come forward?
Yep.
Mr. Newmaster, please come forward.
confused.
I'm just bringing in the testifier.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ealing with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Apologize, we were delayed in the hallway momentarily. I'm here to testify today on behalf of HF 155, and I'll provide a two-part analysis that outlines why this bill provides the best resolution to the issue of license plate reader regulation. The first part of the analysis involves looking closely at what LPR technology provides, and it's our organization's position and belief that the policy that guides the use of government technology, especially technology that collects data on individuals, should be narrowly tailored to meet a specific purpose. As you've heard, LPR allows the automation of a formerly manual process of checking vehicle plates against existing police databases for open warrants, stolen vehicles, and the like. Industry literature speaks to this capability, as does the testimony that you've heard in recent weeks. It's clear that using LPR to generate hit data that correlates to plate images or existing law enforcement leads provides a public safety benefit. The use of LPR for a specific and limited purpose should be supported, and HF 155 enables this specific purpose and would convert hit data to private or non-public status for subsequent use by law enforcement. As this committee has also heard previously, LPR generates a byproduct of data, non-hit data, data that does not correlate to information in police databases, and this data contains the location of vehicles and thus individuals that are not related to existing law enforcement operations. This non-hit data accounts for the vast majority of LPR data, and its existence triggers the second part of our analysis. Non-hit LPR data has generated the bulk of the discussion and debate in this discussion so far over LPR information, and we believe that the answer to regulating this sort of data is found by looking to our nation's history and tradition. The American legal system has a long-standing tradition of limiting the collection and maintenance of data on individuals unless that data has an identifiable law enforcement purpose, as opposed to merely a possible or speculative purpose. We see this in the Fourth Amendment's calls for specificity in warrants, as opposed to the open and general warrants of the British Crown. In the 1960s, when the first federal wiretap laws were written, minimization procedures were put in place so that non-pertinent telephone conversations heard through wiretaps were not collected or archived. Likewise, in the 1970s, the U.S. Attorney General instituted procedures under which the FBI could only open investigations and gather data if a criminal predicate was first met, expressly limiting the FBI's ability to gather data and maintain data that was not relevant to a criminal investigation. The advent of mass collection technologies, whether LPR or other techniques, have begun to place strains on this long-standing premise. Such technologies allow larger and larger data sets to be gathered on the public in general for possible and speculative purposes, rather than focusing specifically on suspected or known lawbreakers. And this has caused a rift to develop between our tradition and our technological capabilities. And today we'd urge this committee to cast its vote on the side of tradition. Since this debate started 3 years ago, we've supported the idea that non-hit data should be kept only as long as necessary to technically separate the hit data from the non-hit data, and this bill accomplishes that purpose by keeping hit data and discarding the non-hit data thereafter. Finally, and most importantly, it's worth noting that the debate over non-hit LPR data is bigger than just this single technology. With LPR, the Minnesota legislature will be establishing for the first time how it will treat data from mass surveillance technologies, including drones, facial recognition, and more. What's decided this session will have long-range consequences and will set the baseline for the future relationship between the government and its citizens in the realm of technological surveillance. And we believe this bill sets the correct and appropriate precedent for these consequential matters, and we urge you to support it. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an easy question. I'm just wondering, sir, if you could repeat the organization you're with. I didn't catch all
of it. Oh, certainly. Sorry. Minnesota Coalition on Government Information.
On Governmental Information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative,
for being late.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ealing, can you tell me Where is the prevailing trend with states overall in the direction they're going with the amount of time they're retaining non-HIT data currently?
Representative, many states have taken a longer time frame for retaining LPR data. We believe that's going in the wrong direction, and we would like to see Minnesota take the lead in shortening that retention time frame for non-HIT data, data that's not relative or relevant to an ongoing investigation.
Well, Representative Lutz. Mr. Chair, Mr. Ayling, I heard about recent states, and I can't even recall it right now, but doing 15 days and lower. Previously, in previous years, I had heard longer, but as more, when I'm talking about more recently, in the last few months or the last 6 months, I've heard of shorter times. Am I incorrect on my understanding of that?
Mr. Ealing.
Representative, there is one state that recently passed a seven-day retention, so that was a more recent, that's a state out east that I can't recall off the top of my head, but it is one of the shorter retention periods that has been passed, and that is a more recent instance.
Okay. Representative Lett.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ealing, a few years ago there was a commercial on television where there was a voiceover, and it showed Officer Friendly driving through the streets, kind of keeping an eye on the neighborhood, and there was a burglar getting ready to rob something. And it panned back and forth from one scene to the other, and the voiceover was explaining how law enforcement is developing more tools to track crime, and not only are they developing more tools to track crime, but actually prevent crime before it happens. And at the last scene of the commercial, there was this burglar coming around the corner of a 7-Eleven or something to rob it, and there was Officer Friendly leaning up against the hood of his squad car with a cup of coffee, and the burglar kind of slunk back around the side of the building and didn't even try anything. Victory for law enforcement. The commercial offered to trumpet the values of actually anticipating crime, preventing it before it happened by being able to track behavior. What is wrong with that as an effort, and does this bill get in the way of that?
Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Representative. The tracking of possible crime, say the filing of suspicious activity reports that's part of intelligence data in other states, that has at its base some connection to suspected criminal activity. Someone has observed something that's unusual, they file a report about it. The difference with this is that this is mass surveillance of all activity going on. Unconnected, there's no baseline connection to anything even being unusual or out of sorts. And so if you're keeping all of that non-relevant data in the hopes that someday there may be criminal activity associated with it, there is no logical way to stop that once you start down that line. Once you say we're going to collect data that's not relevant to any criminal activity but might be in the future, there is no logical stopping point. And so that's why we are very, very focused on making sure that HIT data is maintained, non-HIT data is destroyed.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ealing, let me give you an example. Let's say there's during session some big fundraiser for Ziggy Wilfs or something when he's building the stadium, okay? And the public's concerned that the legislature is going to be colluding to give a team owner a lot of money for a boondoggle. I can't imagine how that had happened. But let's say someone decides to park a squad outside the SOB ramp when there's a fundraiser going on, and tracking when legislators are coming and going and keeping tabs on legislator. There could be criminal activity going on there. What would be wrong with that?
Mr. Ealing.
I think our tradition leans on, to the degree that you can identify specific individuals and track those individuals and gather data on those individuals, that's the threshold from which you begin. And to the extent that we can minimize the gathering of indiscriminate data, even if there's a speculative purpose, we would urge that that is the dividing line in the definition.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any other questions or comments for this testifier? Mr. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little concerned on the zero retention. I've talked to a lot of different departments, a lot of different officers on how these license plate readers are used in certain circumstances. If there's a kidnapping or a child abduction, the license plate readers, if if there's a car, if there's a squad that can respond to the scene that does not have a reader, they do that. The squads that have the readers, they go out and patrol the area. They're grabbing license plates for the investigation, see who's in. So when they do have a suspect, they can check to see if that vehicle was in the area. Now, with this bill, it does not allow that. I'm concerned about those kids. I want to get those kids back safe. And it's a good program to do that. So I have a lot of reservations on this bill because it cuts off the arm of law enforcement to do their job to protect us. So I think, I know you're concerned about the data that's in that store. I think the way to do that is more on policy and procedures, how to look at that data. Not just destroy it, but how to look at it in a proper way that meets the requirements for the standards to protect that data. And if there's violations with people inappropriately looking at that, if it's in policy that they can't do that without the proper authorization, then strict discipline and repercussions can occur to them immediately. But if you put it in statute and make it law, it could take 3-4 years before it goes into, gets into court and a guilty verdict. And some of these cities, counties, or even the state might be paying these people 3-4 years of salary on while they're not even at work because they're on administrative leave. So it's, I think we have to look very closely at how we do this and make sure we do it right. Because we have two constitutional issues, protecting people's rights and protecting their safety. And we have to make sure we do this properly.
Mr. Ealing?
Respectfully, to respond to your concern, the concern that we would have with putting this information in a lockbox and then granting access to it is that you start going down the road of the arguments that the National Security Agency has made, for instance, where they want to gather all of our telephone metadata, keep it in a lockbox, and then say, well, under our reasonable suspicion standard, that's when we can start accessing it. But it starts to break down this tradition where we have generally not gathered information on people that have, there's no relation to criminal activity. And certainly, if we gather all the information that we are now technically capable of doing so, you might be able to find bad actors, you might be able to find instances of criminal activity. That is certainly the case, just statistically, if you gather all that information. We're again concerned about the logical breakdown of a long-standing tradition.
Representative Johnson? Yeah,
I understand that, but I also have to look for the safety of these kids and these victims. Because I don't want to cut off an arm or a tool that could be valuable in getting them back safely. So like I say, we have to look at it very closely and make sure we do this properly, and in some cases make there an exception to the zero, if we go as zero, for those investigative purposes, for the safety of the citizens of Minnesota, if it deals with a criminal activity, trying to, like in a kidnapping, get that person back safe.
Mr. Ealing?
No, I think we will agree to disagree on that point.
Any other questions or comments for this testifier? Representative Lesh.
I had a question, Mr. Chair. You know, if there's a kidnapping, Representative Johnson, that would certainly fall under the gamut of probable cause, would it not? I mean, if someone was kidnapped and it was the child's father or something, there would certainly be probable cause to track that individual's license plate location.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, the problem is you wouldn't have probable cause that the information would be in the system. That's where the problem is. You'd have to know it's in there to be able to look into it.
Well, and Mr. Chair,
Representative
Johnson, you know, I understand that. And I think where we've run into problems in the past is for about 3 years now, I have offered law enforcement an opportunity to negotiate based on that point. And I have essentially been met with stonewall. Nope, we're not going to talk about it. We need this information. And I met with the same talking points you just offered. No, this is really important to protect our kids. And I said, okay, every scenario that's been given, there would have been probable cause or at least reasonable suspicion to broach that. But in light of the lack of cooperation, there's no reason for us to go down this road, because the tradition that Mr. Ayling talks about is exactly right. It is a critically important tradition of this country that we don't track people. They make movies about this, Minority Report and all kinds of things, and you know, you can say they're ridiculous, but people said that all kinds of things were ridiculous in the 40s that we're doing now. And it's important to remember that when we break this kind of contract that we have with the people, we need to be accountable for it. So, by the way, we don't know what you're doing wrong. And when I had the Minneapolis Chief of Police sitting in here, and I asked her, what kind of crime do you think I'm going to do in the next 60 days that you don't know right now? Why do you need to track my location for the next 60 days? And she said, well, Representative Lesh, because we don't know what we don't know. That's not a good enough reason to track innocent people. It's just not. So the speculation about the things that could go wrong, you're absolutely right, and you're accurate. But that requires that law enforcement come forward with some kind of individualized justification. But they don't want to do that. They say, nope, we don't know what we don't know. Therefore, we're going to track all of you. At this point, 0 days is reasonable, absent some kind of good faith effort on the part of law enforcement to offer why they need to track innocent people. So just my soapbox. Thanks for listening, Representative Johnson.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to counter a little bit to Representative Lesh. I was on the conference committee in the last biennium when they couldn't reach agreement. And I asked one of the questions of both sides and said, so you've had a license plate reader in a parking lot where a rape took place. Doesn't the defendant want to know all the people that were in the area as well so that he could have information to potentially exonerate himself if he isn't guilty and he's the one that's charged? And if you don't keep the hit data, you actually may be destroying exonerary evidence that the defendant didn't do it. Or maybe there was someone else who has had multiple offenses of the same type in the area at the time. And so I think 0 days, I think I'm going to support Representative Cornish's bill. I'm not going to support your bill, Representative Scott. I think that there are a lot of things that we can do. I just think your bill goes way too far.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for bringing this bill. And we've had a few conversations about this. And I'm going to support your bill today, but mainly for the reason that I want to move it on to Representative Cornish's committee, and I want to have more discussion. I just feel really uncomfortable with the 0 days as well, but I think it's a good idea to move this on and have more discussion. So thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Mr. Ealing, thank you. The next testifier, Mr. Gumberlin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Don Gumberlin. Okay. My children and I have a game we play as to the interesting ways in which the name Gumberlin is pronounced. Okay. It really is Gumberlin. It's pronounced the way it looks.
Sir, duly noted.
Okay, thank you. You're not even close to how bad it can be sometimes. I think my favorite was Gumberdink. How anybody got there, I'm not real sure. So I'm not going to say much more than Matt has already told you. We support Representative Scott's bill. We support it for the reasons given. The only thing I think I've said this all the way along. I caution you that the thing that Matt said about precedent, I think, is very important. You know, we're right in the middle of implementing all kinds of interesting technologies, okay? And those technologies are going to present issues to you. And if you don't develop some kind of comprehensive set of principles, then you're going to be making it up kind of as you go along. And, you know, one of the things that always amazes me about the Data Practices Act, if you're crazy enough to sit down and read the whole thing, is the strange inconsistencies one finds in the statute. So I know the legislature tries to have consistent application of public policy, in part because that's a noble goal, but it also helps the world that you're regulating be able to understand what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it. So, you know, I'm not going to bore you with a long recitation of technology, but this is only this really isn't the beginning, because you have technology-oriented stuff in the Data Practices Act already. But over time, you're going to be seeing more and more discussion about how to deal with technology. And the other part of this, which is like, I'm trying to think of some decent metaphor, but at some point you're going to have to start trying to deal with the public sector or the private sector, because that's what a lot of people are concerned about these days. The fact that everything we do on the internet is tracked by somebody. Actually, it's tracked by multiple somebodies. And, you know, without principles, you're going to be struggling with a lot of specific detail. So we appreciate Representative Scott's efforts. We appreciate Representative Cornish's efforts. And we hope you find a decent solution.
Any questions or comments for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you, sir. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Rich Neumeister. Just in answer to a question that Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh asked, what's been happening is that when the new technology, an LPR technology came out, a lot of people didn't know about the implications of it. So there were longer periods of time and all that. But since a lot of more research is being done, privacy groups in the communities across the country, there's starting to be a little, what you might call a backlash for more accountability. Even in Congress, there's a talk about having a national regulation of license plate reader technology, Senator Leahy, based on the recent things which you have in your pocket about the DEA and how the sharing on a national level from local agencies, LPR data, up to the feds. Indiana has a bill that's basically saying, just recently introduced, 24 hours you keep it. Then if you want to get access to it, you got to do it through a warrant. The state of Virginia, as best as I can tell, has recently passed a law that says 7 days only you keep non-hit data, basically. If it's past 7 days, you can only be kept for a ongoing criminal investigation. So the trend, if you look across, is there's more buildup, more accountability. And one of the arguments that where you have more accountability is less days, or you build it up, or you're very specific, or you do a warrant, and it's all over the board. But things are changing. Massachusetts has just introduced a new revised bill because of all the things that people are learning about and their policymakers are learning about. So I just wanted to put that at least on record of some of the things that are just happening right now. Thank you.
Any questions or comments for Mr. Neumeister? Seeing none, thank you. Any other testimony from the audience? Yeah, Representative Lesh.
I have a technical amendment, if I may. I would like to, on lines 1.12, 1.17, 1.22, 2.2, and 2.6, I would like to strike R and insert is. Because, members, the word data is a collective noun, and there is a trend to pluralize it that we have been back and forth on for years. And unless we want to start saying the water in this building are safe to drink, or the money in your wallet are gone, we should be consistent and change R to is.
And Representative Lesh, just for clarification, could you repeat the numbers again?
Yes. Please? The line, the change, striking R and inserting is would be found on lines 1.12, 1.17, 1.22, 2.2, and 2.6.
Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lesh. I just wanted to make sure, I know we made some changes from is to R and R to is in statute a couple years ago. I just wanted to check with House Research to make sure that what you proposed was being consistent with that. I don't disagree.
Well, I can answer that for you, okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
It is not consistent because there has been a plot afoot for the last 10 years to change everything to R. If you look at the statutes prior to that, unless they've been messed with by people, they all say is. So I'm interested in the traditional way, Madam Chair. Yes. By plot, I mean conspiracy.
Does research?
I drink only rainwater and pure grain alcohol also.
Research.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch and Representative Scott, I think that description is correct. There has been a trend to go towards data R recently, but I guess it's the will of the committee of how you'd like to grammatically refer to it here.
Representative Scott?
I guess I don't have a problem with it. If there's a problem with it later, I guess we'll be doing a reviser's bill to make the change, but I would leave it for committee members to vote however they see fit.
Representative Lesch, with that said, Representative Scott, Representative Lesch, you make said motion.
I do, Mr. Chair.
One moment. Representative Pinto, do you have a comment before we vote?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've been looking online at a couple style guides, and it looks like it could be used either way, depending on whether you want to emphasize that it's a unit or a collection of individual items. And it does seem like, in this case, we're thinking of it collectively as a unit. So I guess I would go with Representative Lesch's point. Thank you.
So we have a motion for those five lines, R to is. Any other discussion before we vote? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesch, have you reviewed this statute that this goes into to confirm that it's consistent with the other sections of the statute that you're placing this in?
Representative Lesch.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. Yes, I have, which is why I answered the question that it is not consistent because parts of the chapter still retain the traditional use of is, but the trend... it's clearly an agenda on the part of certain individuals to change to R. That's a joke. But no, it's not consistent. I'm interested in the traditional way of doing it in opposition to a new trend of moving toward R.
Any other discussion, comments before we vote? Seeing none, we shall vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay.
Nay.
No.
Motion passes.
The motion passes. With that said, is there any other questions or the anyone else from the audience before we close the public testimony portion? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Any other discussion or comments on the bill? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott. I want to thank you for dealing with this issue. It's a very tough issue that we have to deal with this year because of some of the things that are going on. Although I don't 100% agree with what's in here, I do want to pass this bill on for further discussion because I think we do need to really look at it and we do need to come up with a good compromise because, like I said, we do need to get something passed this year.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just encourage folks to allow this bill to move on to public safety where they have an equal interest in getting the right policy, and I want them to be able to vet both of these bills side by side as we have in this committee. And with that, I'd ask for people's support.
And with that, Representative Scott renews her motion to have House File 155 re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. A roll call, thank you, as amended. And a roll call has been requested, so a roll call shall be performed.
Chair Scott.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Applebaum.
Aye.
Representative Grunhagen.
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Hoppe.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Lesch.
Aye.
Representative Lohmer.
Aye.
Representative Pinto. Representative Schoen.
No.
Representative Vogel.
Aye.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
With the count of 9-4, the motion passes.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
On to House File 222.
Thank you.
Welcome, Representative Cornish. And is there someone that would like to move House File 222? Representative Johnson would like to move House File 222 and have it re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Cornish, go ahead. I believe you have an amendment.
Madam Chair and members, we don't have an amendment, but I think you do.
Representative Cornish, I think you had the DE1 from last time. Are you not offering that? It was submitted again. Were you not going to offer the DE1?
That was my amendment from last time, and then it was held over without action, right?
Right. And so
okay.
Would you like to take it up?
Yes, please.
Okay. Representative Johnson moves the DE1 amendment to House File 222. If you want to go ahead and explain your amendment, that would be fine.
Madam Chair, unless you want us to, I think we walked through that last time, and I would just continue on with the bill.
Okay.
And would you entertain putting up your amendment? Then I can react to the whole bill with the amendment.
Okay.
To save us a lot of time.
All right. All those in favor of adopting the DE1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The DE1 is adopted. And then, members, I have the DE3, and I would like to do a walkthrough with you on the DE3 that is amended to the DE1. And although Representative Cornish's amendment was an improvement to House File 222, I feel that we need some tighter constrictions on this data, and so that's what the DE3 attempts to do. Representative Lesh.
Could you briefly state, I have been remiss and I am not tracking the changes the Representative Cornish made in the DE1.
Okay.
Could you just briefly state what they were?
Representative Cornish.
I'll turn that over to my testifier, Madam Chair, if you don't mind.
Okay. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, the language that was proposed really began.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Paul Schnell, the Chief of Police for the City of Maplewood, and member of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. It laid out essentially identified what the systems were capable of, identified the conditions under which and how the data would be classified as non-public. It had the provisions of a 90-day point of retention through which that data could be accessed by the law enforcement agency when there was an active and open investigation. And it had a number of conditions through which law enforcement agencies were required to maintain access logs. Personnel were required to secure authorization in writing prior to accessing the data. It had a reasonable suspicion requirement for accessing the data, it also had the requirement that we would notify, there would be notification, public notification of the use of the technology and the placement of fixed or stationary units that were put into service throughout Minnesota.
So
those were the essential components.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, thank you, Chief. And so I'm curious specifically about the reasonable suspicion standard that you put in. What kind of hoops do you have to jump through as a chief then to get to that? And how is the written justification saved?
Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, the requirement of reasonable suspicion would be that we would have to have an articulable set of facts
that would suggest that the data that we may possess would be pertinent to an active and open investigation, including a case number, and we would need to lay a basis for that. An employee, an employee or investigator with Maplewood would be required to present that to me or another command staff if they were so designated. Ultimately, I would be responsible as the chief law enforcement officer. They would make the case essentially that the conditions of met, what the case is, and they would identify a kind of a brief factual basis for what it is they are, why it is they need to access this, and how it's pertinent, and we would establish those sets of facts to determine reasonable suspicion.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
And Chief, what would the consequences be for a law enforcement official that failed to do that, or maybe got squishy about the facts? Because this is not going before a judge at all, of course, right? So what would happen to that data or that investigation if the procedure were not followed?
Chief Schnell, was that outlined in either the amendment or the bill?
Madam Chair, it was not specifically discussed, although there was provision set in the legislature last year. There was audit requirements that would need to be accomplished with this bill. That I would identify that, number one. Number two is that the accountability measures that were identified by the legislature last year, were there to be wrongdoing on the part of an officer, would be something that they would be subject to.
Well,
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking is, under the traditional system that we use, if there are either unlawful or unconstitutional actions taken in order to procure certain evidence, the exclusionary rule applies, which means, you know, it can't be used in court. And everyone has dealt with that for 60 years. And so I'm assuming, and the reason for that is, you know, normally it goes before a judge, right? A judge signs off on the warrant, or she doesn't sign off on the warrant. And then if the parameters of the warrant are breached, well, then the exclusionary rule applies. Well, in this instance, there's no judge signing off on it. And I presume it would fall under another standard, what we call in Minnesota as a Rasmussen hearing, to determine whether the evidence has been legally obtained. I'm trying to wrap my head around how it works in this way, if it would just work in the same way despite the fact that there was no judicial intervention.
Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I think I understand the issue that you're identifying. I would say, however, that law enforcement officers around this state and around this country are making decisions on the basis of reasonable suspicion every day. And while certainly there have been times when those judgments have been in error or wrong, and to your point, there is or would be mechanisms whereby they could be held accountable and or that data could be excluded in a case through a rapid proceeding, as you suggested or identified. But ultimately, I believe that the provisions that are laid out do provide clarity for why we're accessing the data that would be publicly available, that people would be able to see what was the reason, the set of facts that ultimately resulted in the need to secure authorization to access the data that we may have on non-HIT data for purposes of attempting to further an investigation.
Great. Well, thank you. Madam Chair, just briefly, and thank you for that, Chief. This amendment then represents, I think, a forward step on the part of law enforcement. I still have some concerns, but, you know, thanks, I guess, is what I'm trying to say for offering this. That's all I'll say for now. I'll wait to hear about the rest of the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Chief, when you first got your LPRs, I take it you had a personnel policy put in effect of how they're properly used. Is that correct?
Chief Schnell.
I have sooner.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, we have a policy that dictates how these systems are to be utilized and accessed.
Representative Johnson.
I know I've talked to a number of chiefs, a number of sheriffs that have this equipment, and all of them have policies and procedures put into place And what they've informed me is, if there, in response to Representative Lesh's question about people misusing it, when it's in a policy, discipline can be immediate. So it actually works much better than statute, which can take a long time because of the assumption of innocence until proven guilty in court. So disciplinary actions could be taken immediately and issue resolved for improper use of the technology.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson. Representative
thank you, Madam Chair. Chief, could you tell me, if they use the search of the non-hit data, that'll be documented in a supplement by the officer, is that correct?
Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that would be fully documented, that they, what they accessed and whether or not it proved fruitful in furthering the investigation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chief, the defense attorney would get a copy of all of the discovery on whether or not they, how and for what purpose they accessed that data. Is that correct?
Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes, they would be provided with full access to all data pertinent to the investigation.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so at some point, if the defense attorney wanted to bring a motion before the court to have that information excluded, they would have the ability to put the officer on the stand to testify about how and why he used that data. Is that correct?
Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. That happens routinely.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the judge would have the ability to exclude any of the data that was collected if they felt that it did not comply with office policy or state statute. Is that correct?
Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes, that is correct.
Representative Hillstrom.
Nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions on the Cornish Amendment? Seeing none, I'll begin a walkthrough of the DE3. First of all, on page one, section one, it just states that there is an inventory that is required and that that inventory will be public. It also covers the definition of surveillance technology. The report requires reporting to be done once a year on the inventory that is maintained and used, or may be maintained and used if they're prospectively thinking of purchasing an ALPR or some form of technology. If you go to page two, there's definition of what an ALPR is and the limitations to the data collected by the ALPR, and those are listed on lines 2.28 through 2.30, and those limitations are the license plate numbers, the date, time, and location data on vehicles, and pictures of license plates, vehicles, and areas surrounding the vehicles. Collection of any data not authorized by this paragraph is prohibited, so it is limited to those specific things. It is also, the data would be classified as private unless, but it could be classified as well as active criminal investigative data, and so that also would be non-public data until after the investigation is completed. Top of page three. There must be additional evidence and reasonable suspicion to classify it as active criminal investigative data. Moving on, under letter C, the agency cannot develop or organize its own data files, nor can it make a centralized repository or develop a centralized depository for all this data. It cannot be used to target or track persons at specific locations without a warrant. And then what this amendment does is it allows for 7 days retention by law enforcement. If you look at line 3.22, some of you know that there's a program called the Safe at Home program, and this is an exemption for that, so that those victims of domestic abuse would not have any of their data made public. Moving on to subdivision 4, in order to share data with another law enforcement agency, a subpoena must be obtained. In the case of the feds wanting any of this information, the data would have to be related to the commission of a crime. Moving on, data from an LPR cannot be shared with, disseminated, sold, or traded with any other individual or entity unless specifically authorized by law. Subdivision 5 talks about the log, that there's a log of use required. It specifies what must be kept in that log of use. And as you can see at the on page or on 410, that the list is not limited to just these things, but it can be, it expands to similar categories of information. There should be a quarterly audit, and that would include, and that would be an independent quarterly audit done by an outside entity. It would audit the records to determine whether the data currently in the records are classified correctly, how the data are used, and whether they were destroyed as according to the section of law. The results of the audit are public, and the audit shows that a law enforcement agency, if the audit shows that a law enforcement agency is out of compliance with the requirements of this subdivision for more than two times in a calendar year, two consecutive audits, then that law enforcement agency would have to suspend its operation until the legislature authorizes them to continue using it. A report summarizing the results of each audit must be provided to the chair and the ranking minority members of this committee or the committees with jurisdiction over this section of law. For authorization of data, the responsible authority for a law enforcement agency must establish written policies to ensure that law enforcement personnel have access to the data only if authorized in writing on a case-by-case basis by the chief of police, the sheriff, or the head of law enforcement agency. And it tells under those parameters what information must be present in order to access the data. The next section is very similar to the law that we put in place surrounding MNsure. As far as what happens with, no, actually, this isn't that section. This talks about unauthorized access and by an employee. And if the employee is found to be negligent, they could get up to 6 months, or they would get a suspension without pay of 6 months. If they're found to willfully abuse this part of law, then they would be subject to termination. The next section talks about the notification to the Bureau of to the BCA, and that the any agency that acquires an LPR technology would have to notify the BCA of what that is, what they've purchased, and within 10 days of installation. Subdivision 10 talks about First Amendment activities and states that an automatic license plate reader may not be used at any event, activity, or assembly subject to the protection of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution without written authorization by chief of police, sheriff, or head of law enforcement agency. And then finally, in Section 4, the agencies would have to have a policy which, as far as I know, the ones that do have a policy or do have LPRs do have a policy, but it would have to encompass the laws in this section of law. So with that, I know Representative Cornish would like to first make some comments on the amendment, so I'll let him go.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I'm still looking for a way to reconcile this bill. I and law enforcement are totally against the amendment. We had wished that it be voted down, and I'll go into the reasons why, but I do thank you for the move on retention, but everything else seems like it got buckled down where the bill is be completely useless. In fact, if it came to my committee, which it is, I would probably hold it over. The law enforcement's credit, they want to continue working on the solution. I told them to pull the pin on this bill several days ago because with it, it basically neuters and eviscerates the whole bill. With this amendment, I mean, it's worthless. So if it comes into my committee, I would have to change it completely around to suit us, and therefore there would be a big fight on the floor. And as we all know, leadership isn't going to let this bill come to the floor if we're not in agreement. So if the amendment is added, I see this as probably an end to the reconciliation of this whole bill. And if I could love to finish the whole presentation here, it's just that we thought that we were really serious about coming to a resolution and wanted a negotiated agreement. But when you talk about quarterly audits, I'd have to ask research if that's even done anywhere, and how you define the amendment, whether they could set up outside of what you talk about, and how you would define that. The subpoena, the encumbrances are so awful in this thing for law enforcement, the hoops to jump through, that anybody thinking about a system like this would just say no. But all the people that have it, and that's why I say if you pull the bill back, then law enforcement doesn't have the audits. They don't have the logbooks. They don't have the hoops to jump through. They don't have any of this thing. So I'm giving credit to law enforcement for sticking in this game to the end, because without a bill, which there wouldn't be if we can't come to an agreement, they've got everything that they wanted, save the protection of the privacy if we put that on again. So I'm kind of at a loss of what to do, because if the amendment passes and comes to my committee, it's a non-starter out of there. So can I go through the points here to the bill now?
Certainly.
We do thank you for the move and the retention, but such a short retention period really limits the technical, the capabilities for law enforcement. And it was said that there is a state that went to a 7-day retention period recently, but I say to that, so what? I actually believe the retention periods are going to get longer, because the more the system is used and the more major cases it's solved and found out how valuable it is, I think the retention periods will get longer. The only reason I think of such a short retention period is it's admittedly LPR data hasn't been out in the public eye a lot. When they found it, and then certain people say, and I'm not saying you folks, but Armageddon is going to happen and the sky is going to fall in, they look at shorter periods. Once they realize what the bill does and the capabilities we have of solving crime, I think that the actual retention periods will get longer. And to take one state and say they passed a 7-day retention period, that's the lowest in the nation. It's almost unheard of. I mean, Texas has the death penalty. Are we going to model our state after that? So to cherry pick one state out and hang your hat on the short retention period, we don't think is really fair. And we've talked to you folks about crimes reported a week or a month or a year after they occur. That's why we need the longer retention period. The warrant lines, we feel it's unreasonable to ask law enforcement and the courts to issue a warrant to view a license plate on a vehicle on a public street. The only difference between there's some differences between this system, but an officer can enter literally hundreds of license plates into the MDT right now on a check in a given night. Now you're talking about basically the same system and having a warrant. The annual audits, we support annual audits. Our idea was once in every 3 years. We thought you folks might, come down to 2 years or 1 year. But, I mean, 4 audits a year? It just seems totally unreasonable. It seems to me that some of the advocate groups sensed that we were coming close to a reconciliation on the time, and they got so worried about that they decided to kill the bill by adding other things once the retention period was going to be better, because even if you gave us a 30-day retention period, all of these things makes the use of the technology so encumbersome. The disciplinary lines of 513 and 525, we support the law that took effect in August of 2014 that makes unauthorized access of a government database a criminal offense. We wonder why we didn't mirror that instead of jumping into disciplinary actions at a local level, why we didn't just take up something similar to that. The sharing of the ALPR data, the sharing among the police agencies is critical to solving crimes quickly, and we support safeguards including a legit law enforcement purpose, a reasonable suspicion. The administrative subpoena, I think with all that, is not necessary, and it's just one of those hoops again that I think that we have to jump through. The centralized ALPR database, In order for this to be effective, there's got to be a centralized database that stores license plate numbers of vehicles that have been reported stolen and wanted in connection with a crime such as Amber Alert. And the BCA currently provides such a database, and we support that in continuing. This was a Senate floor amendment last year and wasn't intended to be in the initial draft language. And then there's a section here about drones in your... I didn't even want to go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Representative Cornish, that's on the first page, and that's just in the definition of surveillance technology. That's the only reference there.
Okay. And the whole drone thing, I didn't even plan on hearing anything about that in my committee. You're addressing that, and it kind of just gets in a little bit that the other people are going to jump onto, that anybody wants anything done to the drone once we enter that into the language. So, Madam Chair, I don't know how we fix it, because it's put in a DE1 amendment. If there was a separate amendment, I appreciate the movement on the retention period, but everything else here takes away any attractiveness in the bill for me that had, even with the short retention period. So I don't know where to go from here, because if the amendment's defeated, then you're not going to be happy, and we're not going to come to a resolution, because we have to have this on the floor. And so I don't know how to address this. I'll leave it up to your folks how you want to play this out.
Representative Cornish, before we move to member questions, I'd like to hear from members of the public on the DE3 quickly, if anyone would like to have any words about it. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. One has to take a look at what is the basic issue here. You've got interest, privacy, liberty interest, new technology. Law enforcement wants to use this technology. Secondly, we also have to take a look at the history in Minnesota of how law enforcement has abused some of its authority that it's had just in the last decade, whether it be MJNO, where millions of records were kept on many citizens in a private organization. Number two, GangNet, thousands and thousands of people were just put in a database, which is now closed. The whole issue of DVS, and there are other kinds of things happening locally, statewide, and nationally, where people are saying there needs to be accountability. This is what this bill, the DE3 amendment, does. And first of all, the Privacy Commission has been very strong to say, hey, what's out there in the community? What's out there? And so one of the things is the inventory. This is an attempt to get an idea of the kinds of technology that's out there. The DE3 amendment is a lot of the same language that's in the DE1, which is basically from the Senate. And there are some changes. The definition is truly the definition that should be used, from all data collected from these devices, rather than a defined definition, what you have in the proposal. One of the other things that I think is important is that, Madam Chair, as Representative Johnson indicated, he saw on his ride-along on how people were putting things in their own little type of database. Or he came to that point of view. So what 3.6 through 3.10 says, you're only going to use the database, the data file, that's currently under law. People know what's being put in there. And there's an exception, except the locals can do their own if someone is being investigated. On lines 3.9 and 3.10, a central state repository. In Maryland, in California, in other places, they're doing centralized databases on innocent, non-hit scans. This is not the centralized about databases. This is on keeping millions of scans on innocent, law-abiding people of where their locations, and with those pictures, those kinds of pictures that have been part of the testimony. 7 days, it goes off, to where there's some movement. Secondly, that some of the quarterly audits I think are important, or some type of audit. Quarterly is one of those things, and that can be used, for discussion. I have no problem with the subpoena. you know, in the issue of where on the First Amendment rights, we are already aware that LPRs are being placed at gun shows, protest rallies, churches, whatever it may be. Those are, it's very, very clear what First Amendment activities are. I think it's important. And that type of policy is very similar to St. Paul's surveillance policy that they adopted several years ago.
Madam
Chair. Needs to be a sign-off.
Madam Chair.
And
a question for Mr. Neumeister.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. Before I ask a question to Mr. Neumeister, he was just speaking about the First Amendment activities, Subdivision 10. Can you tell me, how did that language come into the DE3 amendment?
Representative Lesch, that was a concern of mine because I knew that that this had been occurring, if not in Minnesota, other places where law enforcement was scanning the license plates at gun shows and those sorts of activities.
Okay. And thank you, Madam Chair. The question I was going to ask is, you know, how we... how that works, because the First Amendment is a prohibition against prior restraints, and I don't know how we anticipatorily, maybe you can answer that, Mr. Neumeister, how would we anticipatorily determine that an assembly is protected by the First Amendment in light of the fact that the First Amendment is simply a prior restraints prohibition? And if you just want to bypass and say wait for the lawyer, that's fine too.
I'll wait for a lawyer, but I'm trying to do some common sense.
Or Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, for me, I just look at it from a common sense perspective. LPRs have been used at demonstrations, at churches, whatever, across the country. There's, and possibly here, I don't know. And so it's just like when law enforcement observes or they infiltrate public meetings or things like that, which is recently with the Bloomington MOA, generally some departments, what they have a policy. It says if law enforcement has to do something with a First Amendment activity, generally, there has to be some accountability to that. And all I'm saying is that I've seen where when law enforcement has been observing political rallies, with the RNC here in Minnesota, in St. Paul, you know, there's a lot of policies. They were even sued over that recently, and they've come to some policies, at least in St. Paul that I've seen, where there needs to be some authorization before there's monitoring of First Amendment activities.
Well, and Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking is I think this language is potentially workable. I hear Representative Cornish's statement that he has concerns about it, and I think I see why based on my question. But there's probably a way to work through that, because I have some of the same concerns. I wonder where you can park a reader to get a whole pool of individuals that you think are doing something wrong when you don't have individualized suspicion. And I wonder if the DE1 amendment has taken care of that, to the extent that if law enforcement is surveilling a pool and they happen upon something that they weren't looking for, based on that articulable suspicion contained in the document they just said they're going to submit, then any evidence collected based upon that surveillance is gone. It's out, because it's fruit of the poisonous tree. So I wonder if that isn't enough of a safeguard against it being used in the method that you stated. Do you think it's not?
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I'm not going to answer. I got to think a little bit more. Madam Chair, if I could, may just finish on just
sure.
a couple more points. One is, there was discussion. When you set one of these cameras, which is rising with technology, with facial recognition features and other kinds of things, in front of a house for a specific person or a location, there is a privacy interest. And that's where some discussion states, whether it's statutorily or by case law, are starting to say privacy interests are expanding. And so I think there should be a warrant in a particular place if you're going to use this kind of technology, particularly as it advances. One of the other things, again, little differences in this amendment. when you're talking about audits, in the DE-1, it doesn't say audit the, how the data is used. It's basically, is it classified or some other thing? One of the important things is when you do audits, you want to take a look how the data is used. And so that's another little word that's placed on this section. So, Madam Chair, for Representative Cornish, she's very much entitled to his opinion. And I've known Representative Cornish for decades. And him and I go back and forth. I help him on some things. He, on another point, believes on some things. He helps, you know, we exchange views. But he knows that this is a big issue. And I think he, I hope, is open to some of these kinds of things rather than just dismiss the whole bill or the whole attempt to try and for some accountability, transparency, as these two strong interests are butting up against each other. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I encourage you to continue on to adopt this amendment and continue on with the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Anyone else in the public wishing to testify? Mr. Gamberling. Go ahead and state your name for the record, please.
You bet. Madam Chair, Don Gemmerling from Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. If I remember correctly, the inventory of surveillance technology, which is in Section 1 of the DE-3, was in the original bill, if I remember. Mm-hmm. And I, at the time, I think we said that this is a good thing. As we go into the advanced era of surveillance technology, part of what I've come to believe is you can kind of limit the abuses with greater transparency. Okay, are there going to be abuses? Well, history tells us, yes, there are going to be abuses. But to the greatest extent that the public knows how law enforcement is using technology, the better off we're going to be, and the better off you're going to be able to make decisions. Okay. So having an inventory, for example, is a good example of that. I'm not going to go into a lot of technical stuff in the bill. Frankly, you know, even though we've supported zero retention from day one, we know, number one, that's not practical, and number two, it's not going to sell. So is 7 days a reasonable compromise? It's a compromise, let's put it that way. And I wish we'd represent Leshko. He's right there. The First Amendment thing in Subdivision 10, that kind of language appears in other states' laws limiting the collection of that kind of information. Now, frankly, off the top of my head, I can't give you one of those states, but I know in the 40-plus years I've been doing this, I've seen that kind of language, and it's usually in some kind of law limiting the government's collection of information about First Amendment activities. There is the possibility, given Representative Lesch's concerns, that it could be fixed a little bit to make it clear that what you're trying to prohibit is the use of technology that's trying to surveil the exercise of rights under the First Amendment. Okay, you know those, and that exercise includes the right of free speech, the right of assembly, the right to petition the government, and the right to exercise religion, okay, without governmental interference and hopefully without governmental surveillance. So you know, we're going to support any kind of compromise that's reasonable, but of course we're all going to disagree about what is reasonable. And I think this is another attempt to come to a compromise. And we appreciate your efforts.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay. Doesn't look like anyone has any questions. Anyone else, member of the public, wishing to testify? Go ahead and state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Specifically with the DE-3 amendment, we do not support it. There are a number of problems. I would just point out a few things that I think are problematic in the language and how we implement it. If you go to line 1.8, if you talk about personal characteristics, as an investigative officer and detective, I would use Google and I would search from my computer a person's name to try to determine information that may or may not be relative to my investigation. Under this bill, in terms of inventory, my computer potentially at my office becomes something that we would use in tracking purposes. It also talks about Facebook and activities of an individual. I mean, if I go on Facebook and all of the other kinds of things in my investigative duties, would that then comply? I talk about property of an individual. If you have real estate transactions or other kinds of things that you can track electronically, all of these kinds of things, is that technology covered under this inventory that we as governmental agencies or entities would have to report? I would also draw your attention to surveillance technology on line 115. The way I read this, as you know, we use surveillance technologies in jails all the time. Building, public works buildings, the Capitol. The way I read this, we will all have to file annual reports on all of the cameras, all of the technologies that we use in all of our governmental entities, jails and everything, every year for every change that we come in with. There's a number of other things in here. 7 days is a movement. Obviously, we want more time. We have a double-edged sword in law enforcement. We need to prove somebody did the crime. We need to exonerate people that they are not involved. And so as we go through and look at this bill, there's issues, and some of these have already been highlighted, and I won't take up any more time. I just want to alert you to the fact that we have concerns about this bill. Be happy to go into much more detail, but I think in the interest of time, I'll just conclude with we're not in favor of the DE3 amendment.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify? Okay, first of all, I think Representative Schoen, you were first on my list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how much do these quarterly audits cost?
Representative Schoen, I don't know.
Madam Chair, who's gonna do them?
That's up to law enforcement to find someone to do them.
So, Madam Chair, our local governments are going to be forced to pick up the bill for quarterly audits, and they're going to have to hire somebody, some random private entity, to come and do quarterly audits on private data?
Representative Schoen, the amendment that Representative Cornish had, an audit every 3 years, do you think that that's adequate?
Madam Chair, I do. I support Representative Cornish's bill, and 3 years seems adequate,
and
that's
so
the compromise, but quarterly is burdensome. I mean, that is unheard of.
Representative Schoen, you are aware that in the past, law enforcement has abused the law by looking at innocent people's data, mine included in that. You're aware of that, and had the audits been done more frequently on that, maybe it wouldn't have gone on for so long. So, you know, quarterly may be tough, and maybe we'll land somewhere in between. But once every 3 years is not adequate. It's a non-starter.
Well, Madam Chair, when you say that maybe audits would have done it well, quite frankly, when you're talking about the Driver and Vehicle Services website, you know, you're talking about a different thing. I understand where you're coming from, but you know, we've taken steps to make sure that the access to that data after the fact is protected more than it was when it was first brought out. And so the steps in DVS have taken the right direction that they've needed to. And we're trying to do that here about saying, here's how you can access it. That's the important part. Mm-hmm. Quarterly is just, if you're going to do something like this, then there has to be remuneration from the state, because that's an unfunded mandate at that point. All I will say is, if you don't want license plate readers, then introduce the bill to ban license plate readers.
Chair.
Representative Blesch.
You know, Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, this, I think we need to remember where we came from here.
Because the suggestion that, oh my gosh, our hands are being tied, why don't you ban license plate readers? If we were talking about hit data, that would be one thing. Okay, the express statement is we want license plate readers to take care of all the work cops had to do in tracking hit data that they used to have to do. But this entire conversation is for three years now has been about the non-hit data, which was not available unless cops were taking those little post-it notes in their squads, handing them off to the secretary down at the office, and they were hand-entering them into a database, which was not happening. So the 99% of the stuff we're talking about is the non-hit data, and that is a significant new either tool or concern, depending on how you want to look at it. And I just think it's a lot more complicated than said, well, we want to ban license plate readers, because I know that for me, that's not true. The technology is out of the barn. It's going to be out there. But some of these safeguards, I think, should have a reasonable conversation. And I think what Representative Scott is offering as an amendment is legitimate. And you might be right. You know, quarterly, wow, administratively, it's going to be impossible. I could be persuaded on that. But I still think the conversation is important.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I mean, not that I always agree with Mr. Franklin, but I mean, that's a great point on all our cameras and everything else. Everything is under surveillance. I mean, it's not just license plate readers that may affect. That goes a whole different direction.
Representative Johnson.
So I don't know what the answer is here. I mean, at this point, if you're a non-starter and he's a non-starter, then let's vote on this and kill it here then and call it good and just let it be what it is, what it was going to be without legislation.
Representative Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I have a question for Mr. Franklin. Still happens to be here.
He is. He's coming forward.
Mr. Franklin, on lines, on the DE3 amendment, on lines, basically it's 4.26 and 4.27. I'm just wondering if you are aware of any legislation ever passed or even introduced in the past where a law enforcement agency, because of a small error in a inventory or audit, lost their ability to use a piece of equipment until the legislature authorized them by statute to be able to do it again.
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, in my 40 plus years of doing this, no.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask for a roll call.
Thank you. A roll call has been requested. Any further questions from members? Members of the committee? Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair, I was just going to ask for a point of clarification. Are we still on the DE3 amendment, or are we?
Yes, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you.
We're still on the DE3. Members, the intent of my DE3 is to put some really tight guardrails on use of the information. And as Representative Lesh said, most of this is because information is being gathered on innocent people. The hit data is one thing. The non-hit data is a completely different matter. When we're collecting information and it's in the hands of in the hands of law enforcement on innocent people. And I'm certainly willing to work with Representative Cornish going forward, and I hope that I have, maybe I should ask him to come to the table again and just get his word on record that if I withdraw the DE3, that we will move forward. We'll pass his bill as it is amended with his amendment, but that's not the final word on this subject.
Madam Chair, before you bring Representative Cornish to the table, Madam Chair, in the event that any of these provisions get amended into Representative Cornish's bill, I would assume that the bill would be coming back to this committee so that we could take a look at these data pieces. And Madam Chair, even if you withdraw this amendment, I think I probably will reoffer it because I think this committee should take a vote on these issues if we're going to see it again.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch.
I think it's important to proceed in good faith here on this and not just draw lines in the sand. That's how we got 3 years into this in the first place, Representative Hillstrom. So I understand your passion on your side of the issue. I equally have as much passion on my side, but I don't think lines in the sand are a good measure at this point. I like what Representative Cornish and law enforcement has brought forward today with the DE-1. I think it's worth further discussion, but so are the provisions that are contained in your amendment. So I would ask Representative Hillstrom, please reconsider the roll call piece.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to say we passed your bill. I think you're making a wise decision to keep working on this issue. I mean, clearly this is not a partisan issue. Clearly this is a contentious issue. Lots of testimony in for and against, lots of questions for and against from the table. I think that the truth is we're going to come up with something that's going to be somewhere between the bill before us and your amendment. So thank you, and thank you, Representative Cornish, Hillstrom, Lesch, everybody. Thank you all. Thanks. Appreciate it, Madam Chair.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, if you withdraw the amendment and pass the bill out in the present form, I guarantee you that I have no intention of putting a bill out of my committee that you definitely disagree with, because I think that it'll never come up on the floor if that's the case. So I would be very interested in working with you on in law enforcement and get everybody together, and especially if we got time for like 3 minutes to run over the changes that have taken place, or do you rather?
We're done at 10, and I know Representative Applebaum has a question, so.
Just a couple of bullet points here. I just want to reemphasize the changes we made since we started out to now with the present bill.
Go ahead, Mr. Potts, introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Jeff Potts, the police chief from Bloomington. And just to kind of highlight a couple of things, so we came into the session with plenty of things that were yet to be agreed upon. And just to kind of highlight, 222, the D1 amendment does do a few things that had not been done prior to the session. 90-day retention. That is in the bill. That's not something that would be in law prior to the session. Reasonable suspicion for access of the data is something that did not exist before. Agreeing that, you know, to try to calm the issue or calm the concern about the data existing and putting in place proper protections, identifying good protections, I think, is key to doing that versus just not holding the data. Our citizens really do expect us to be able to solve those cases and those victims, as we're talked about. That data is helpful. So audits, the bill that is in front of you says 3-year triennial audits. I think in our group we can agree that maybe there's some middle ground between that and quarterly. Quarterly is very tough, but we didn't have requirements for audits before. So requiring an audit, requiring the agency to articulate a reason for searching the data is a big step forward in that area of terms of trying to protect the data. Policies and procedures didn't exist before this session. So restrictions on access to the data didn't exist before this. I think we've come a long ways in terms of trying to come up with a compromise that really does protect the data, but also allows law enforcement to maintain the tool in solving these crimes. There are really good protections, and I think in the D1 that didn't exist before today, session.
Thank you for that. Representative Applebaum, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, it's just more of a statement, really. You know, this is the third informational hearing we've had on these issues, and I really think that we should address it here as, you know, arbiters of the LPR program, and, you know, the rest of the House looks to us for guidance on it. And, you know, although I voted on zero retention before, I mean, I think and while there's some certainly some good ideas in your amendment, Madam Chair, I mean, structurally, I just don't think it's right, and I believe that it would indeed die. And in that case, I mean, passing no law in relation to this issue would be a travesty. So that's just my two cents. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Further discussion on this plan, new plan. I will withdraw the DE3 in good faith with Representative Cornish with the promise to work on some of these finer details of the bill. And with that, any further questions from members? Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that this has some significant issues, and I believe that this is the proper place to deal with these issues. So, Madam Chair, I will offer the DE3 amendment, and I would ask for a roll call on it. Madam Chair, I think this has significant problems. I think this is the committee to address them in, and I think we should vote it down.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
To that point, I don't think that that is a good faith effort. When the chair has stated, Representative Hilstrom, that she's going to withdraw it, but in order to get a hash mark in your column, you want to jeopardize a negotiation process, so I would remind committee members that they are not required to take a vote on a roll call if they don't want to, and I won't be taking one.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, in our rules, it specifically says that when someone offers an amendment, that any member of the House can reoffer the amendment, even if the amendment is withdrawn. If Representative Scott wanted to, in good faith, proceed with negotiations, one of the things she could have done was offer these amendments to her own bill to keep it in place. She passed it on. Look, we have two bills on the same issue that are proceeding, and it's time that this committee take a stand on where we're going to end up. I think it's appropriate, and I think it's well within the rights of any member to offer any amendment. I think it's a bad amendment, and I don't think that the good faith negotiations have necessarily been going on, and therefore, I'm offering it, and I'm asking for a roll call. And if people don't want to vote on it, they can choose to take a pass.
With that, members, we are recessed.
We will reconvene the Civil War Data Practices Committee. Thank you for being here in this very close room on a kind of a stuffy evening. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, when we recessed the last committee, I had offered the DE3 amendment, hoping that we would actually have the debate in committee. It's my understanding that there's been some interim discussions, so I am agreeing to temporarily withdraw the DE3 amendment so we can have discussion on the DE4 amendment. And then, Madam Chair, once I do that, based on whatever happens on the DE4, if you would just call on me so I can determine whether or not I will be reoffering the DE3 amendment.
Certainly. And, folks, as per our committee rules, the chair waives the 24-hour rule for the DE4 amendment. We did spend some time this afternoon discussing this, and we, I don't know if we have 100% peace in the valley because it hasn't been able to be run by everyone that's a stakeholder, but certainly I think we've made some good headway. And so with that, I'm going to have Mr. Gehring go through what the DE4 does.
Madam Chair, should I move the DE4 to get it in front of me?
Sure, if you'd like to move the DE4.
Yeah, just so everyone's aware, Representative Cornish couldn't be here this evening, so I'm his fill-in. So, Madam Chair, I'll move the DE4 to come in front of me. We can have Mr. Gehring go through it section by section.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Gehring.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, what I'm going to do is walk through the changes in the DE4 amendment. In drafting this, largely the base of the DE4 is what was in the DE3 with some deletions and some modifications. So what I'm going to do is walk through section by section and point out where there are changes to the language. So in Section 1, this is the inventory of surveillance technology. The section was in the DE3 amendment with the modification here that language providing that aerial vehicles such as drones are not included in surveillance technology. So that language has been deleted from the DE3 amendment. Section 2 is arrest data, which requires a public disclosure of whether an ALPR was used when an arrest was made. That remains the same as it was in the DE3 amendment. Section 3 is the substantive automated license plate reader data classification section. The definition in Subdivision 1 remains the same as it was in the DE3, so the ALPR means government data derived from an automated reader that captures motor vehicle license plate numbers. In subdivision 2, the only change to the language from what we saw this morning is on line 2.34, the addition of articulable suspicion. So maintenance of data collected from an automated license plate reader without additional evidence and a reasonable articulable suspicion that the data relates to commission of a crime is not sufficient to constitute active criminal investigative data. The remainder of subdivision 2 is the same as what was in the DE3 this morning. In subdivision 3, the biggest substantive change there is the destruction of data requirement moves from a 7-day destruction period to a 30-day destruction period for non-hit data collected by an ALPR. In subdivision 4, sharing among law enforcement agencies, this language is modified to provide that sharing is allowed upon a reasonable articulable suspicion that the data relates to a commission of a crime that applies to both state and federal law enforcement agencies. And there's also new language on 3.27 and 3.28 requiring that the data sharing meet the standards for requesting access to data that's provided later in subdivision 7. This cross-references to the requirement that when making a request, the law enforcement agency include a case number and some other factual basis for the crime that they're investigating. Subdivision 5 on page 4 is substantially the same as what it was in the E3 amendment. Subdivision 6, the audit language. This new language on 4.16 and 4.19 provides for an annual audit as opposed to a quarterly audit, which is what was in the DE3 amendment this morning. Paragraph B has some substantial changes to the procedure when the audit is complete. Under this new language in the DE4, if a law enforcement agency is determined to be in a pattern of substantial non-compliance with the requirements of this section, there's a suspension procedure that prohibits them from using ALPRs until the legislature has authorized reinstatement. The order of suspension would be issued by the Commissioner of Administration upon review of the results of the audit, review of applicable provisions, and after providing the agency a reasonable opportunity to respond to the audit's findings. Page 5, some language that was deleted included a subdivision that provided certain employee discipline procedures if data was accessed without authorization. Language in subdivision 8 related to notification of the BCA. There's language removed from the DE3 amendment that previously required that the BCA authorize law enforcement agencies to use ALPR devices. And finally, what had been subdivision 10 in the DE3 amendment related to First Amendment activities has also been deleted from this draft. And then in section 4, this is the requirement that law enforcement agencies adopt an ALPR reader policy. The policy requirement remains the same, except that the policy must also include employee discipline standards that are consistent with what's currently in section 13.09 that applies to public employees that gain unauthorized access to government data.
Thank you, Mr. Gearing. Before we go to member questions, I'm wondering if Mr. Freeman would like to come to the testifiers table, or Chief Schnell, somebody.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Appreciate the efforts that have been made today to move this forward. Obviously, this is we think this is significant progress. As a profession and as leadership of Minnesota law enforcement, we are here with the hope that we can move forward reasonable standards that will advance the protection of the members of our community. We heard very clearly today and throughout the debate about the importance of maintaining this balance between personal privacy and the law enforcement objectives of holding people accountable who harm our communities. At the same time, we recognize that as part of our system of democracy, we have a system that implied social contract that does suggest that we give up small, realistic, limited amounts of our absolute freedom for the safety and protection and the good of the whole. We are encouraged. There are issues, obviously, that we think we can continue to work out, but we think that progress has been made, obviously, and we are appreciative of you, Madam Chair, and the committee for the efforts to try and move this forward.
Thank you for your comments. Are anybody else in the public that wishes to testify on this amendment? Mr. Neumeister.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Eric Schneemeister. In your handout, which you have, is a definition of what reasonable suspicion is. And I think it's important to know what reasonable suspicion is and where it comes from. It comes basically from the 1968 Terry versus Ohio case. And a reasonable suspicion is basically, I'm going to stop you, I want to pat you down, I want to check you out. It's very low threshold. And the term that is called is articulable facts, pertinent and articulable facts. And putting a reasonable suspicion standard that you are putting here in the two places here, from my point of view, sets a bad precedent. They put thousands and thousands of folks in gang net, primarily a lot of folks from communities of color, based on a reasonable suspicion standard. So I think it's important, as this bill progresses, is to think that you can have language without going to a reasonable suspicion standard so that the public knows what the standards is going to be. Madam Chair, the other point is I think the First Amendment issue is still out there. Across the country, that is one of the fears that the public has. Even a recent poll that I believe that was done in Minnesota that said almost 80% of the people have concerns about location, and it should be based on probable cause if you can collect location and travel there. I'm Minnesotans. I know that was recently done because of all the privacy discussion. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think it's still, you know, a work in progress, and I think very positive. But as a courtesy to let you know, and particularly for new folks who may say, well, who is this character who makes no money and just pops up here quite a lot? I really believe in people's liberties and privacies, and I do compromise. But I am someone that will go constantly because I have known in the years that I've been here that details make difference. And sometimes conference committees, they're reopened. Sometimes before the bill is passed, all of a sudden someone says there's something. And I've done many of those kinds of situations. So that if I approach you on some of these things as the bill progresses, I hope that you'll keep that in mind. I am someone who cares, and there's the other side of the point of view. Finally, Madam Chair, what was it? No, I think that was my point. The federal issue about the access to sharing with the feds across the country, that has been an issue. How maybe to get on record here as this bill progresses, whether it's this committee or the other committee, to ask specifically if the feds are going to ask for the whole database, how is law enforcement going to respond? So once, if you develop questions to get answered by law enforcement on the record, then if you hear of things, then you can come back and change things. Questioning and getting things on the record are one of the important things, particularly when we deal with public safety and the balancing of people's rights. So Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the time that you've taken today, and as it continues.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Anyone else in the public wishing to testify? Go ahead for the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Want to echo Mr. Neumeister's comments. We appreciate the work that's been done in short order on this. As Mr. Gimberling noted, you know, the political process is going to force compromises sometimes. So we realize that there may be a compromise coming on this. Our preference is still HF 155. There are some things that are just very difficult to compromise on, specifically the idea that data that has no relation to criminal activity should be maintained. It's still early in the process. That bill could have a life. That said, if the political process moves ahead with a compromise bill, you're going to want to stock it with these kinds of safeguards that are in here. So in terms of the safeguard language, we feel fairly comfortable what's in there. It is still being worked on, but those are our basic takeaways from this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have some questions for nonpartisan staff who draft.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
Thank you. So, is there any place in statute where it actually requires the legislature to act if there is a suspension? For example, if someone doesn't get the opportunity to look at driver's license data any longer, does it require an act of the legislature to reinstate that, or does someone else do that?
Mr. Gary.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I'd have to look. I'm not aware of other situations where the legislature comes back to authorize access.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Gearing, do you know typically what happens? So if someone loses access, for example, to the Minnesota driver's license, is it, you know, iPad that gives them the ability to access it again? Is it the Department of Motor Vehicle? I mean, who gives folks access when some data is suspended?
Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, normally the responsible authority within the agency makes decisions about access to data. So I think that's the customary way, but there's nothing prohibiting the legislature from setting other standards or procedures for allowing access.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there going to be a fiscal note with someone reviewing this audit information, and if so, who would primarily be charged with reviewing this data from the audit?
Are you asking Mr. Gearing or myself?
Whoever has the answer.
Is that Stacy Christensen? We haven't run this by iPad yet. We haven't had a chance to, but Stacy or Ms. Christensen is here. I don't know if she has a take on that this early in the game or not. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Stacy Christensen with the Information Policy Analysis Division and the Department of Administration. This is the first time that I've looked at this, and so I suppose just a couple of questions that I had when it says a law enforcement agency determined to be in a pattern of substantial noncompliance. I'm not clear who would make that determination, if that would be the Commissioner of Administration or someone else. And then my other follow-up question would be, do all of the results from the audit come to admin for review? So I suppose that would just be some clarifying language with regard to our responsibility.
Thank you. Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair and Ms. Christensen, I think the intent of the language is that the Commissioner of Administration would make determinations about a pattern of noncompliance. And then the report summarizing the results of the audit under paragraph C is required to go to the Commissioner as well as the legislature.
Ms. Christensen?
So, Madam Chair, in that case, I guess it's going to kind of depend on how many, if we're reviewing all of these reports, if there's a lot of substantial noncompliance, you know, it would just kind of depend on
my
situation.
Right. And my understanding is that you would only see the reports where it appears that there's a problem.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I'm trying to get a sense of is who's going to alert who that there might be a problem, and then who's going to do the analysis to see if there is or isn't a problem, and then who's going to decide whether or not they should lose their right to use it, and who's going to pay for that review, or can, you know, just do they have to post it on their website and citizens are going to view it and say, I think they broke the rules, and do they call somebody? I'm just trying to actually figure out how this really works. Because without the determination or the analysis, how is the legislature going to decide whether or not to give those the right to use it back or not? Mm-hmm. Or I think it's mushy.
And I don't disagree with that. I know this is one area that we discussed a lot, but yet we had limited time this afternoon. So it is something that we know probably needs to be, you know, more specific. Representative Lesh, to this point, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think the mushiness, if you will, is well-placed. Because, as has been discussed by law enforcement, for example, if you've got a large department that has a few violations or missteps, that's quite different from a small department that has the same number. And previously in the DE3, there was a number in there. It would have been penalizing some small departments, and for those same numbers for a large department, it may indicate not a pattern of misconduct. So I think that determination is better placed in fact, with the legislature. If this issue comes up, we have an opportunity to weigh in. And the system itself, I think, has a way of vetting that and sorting it out. So I don't think it's as much as a concern that we need to set an actual rubric or flow chart in place, because if there are mistakes, it will get us due attention.
And I would just add, too, that this is new technology. This is something that the legislature is just now getting policy on. And I think it's wholly appropriate for the legislature to have some say in potential abuses of it. And I understand that there probably aren't as many procedural, there's not a lot of procedural language in this, but we just getting going. Representative Hillstrom.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the challenge is the bill doesn't say the legislature is going to suspend the use and the legislature is going to grant it back. The bill says we assume that we're going to suspend, and you only get it back if the legislature acts to give it back. So if you happen to be opposed to anybody having it, you could have a series of someone, who knows who, determining that they're out of compliance, and a whole bunch of folks getting suspended. And if, for example, Madam Chair, you don't take it up, you would never re-grant access to a department. And so you're setting up a system where it's not clear who's going to make the determination, and it's not clear who's going to get to take away the ability to use it, and it's not clear how it is that someone's really going to get it back, the ability to use it. So I think it's mushy, and I don't think that when you're dealing with this kind of information that it should be mushy. And so I don't have a problem with audits. I don't have a problem with somebody making the determination. We should decide who's going to make that determination and what the standard is, and I don't think that's happening.
Okay, well, it hasn't yet. And so I guess I would like to hear, I don't know, the Chief Schnell and some of the other folks in the room that are with law enforcement haven't had a lot of time to digest this language yet. I don't know if you have ideas or moving forward, or if it's something that you would really rather talk to Representative Cornish about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think, you know, certainly we want to make sure that the process is clear. Obviously, even with this, this is a significant consequence, and rightly so, given the data that's being that we're being entrusted with. At the same time, I think it is important that we have that there is absolute clarity that those mechanisms are kind of well established, and the process of whether that is guidelines for an auditing firm that is brought in to what constitutes substantial noncompliance, those things would be extremely helpful. And I think, you know, we'll have to do a lot of work to kind of identify just some of the internal mechanisms. You know, we have a form for laying out exactly who and how investigators can access our LPR data today. There may be things that we have to tweak as a result of this language, and we may need to have more detail, less detail. There's a whole lot of things that I think we'll need to work out as we develop this. But I would hope that there would be the opportunity to kind of further flesh this out so it's fundamentally clear the expectations as well as the consequences.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schnell. I think Representative Johnson has a question.
Chief Schnell, Madam Chair, I've had the opportunity to read a few different personnel policies in the procedures for using the LPR from across the state. Now, Chief Schnell, my question is, I take it your investigators, your detectives, don't have carte blanche access to this. It's limited to just a few personnel that can actually go in and get this information.
I'm sorry, Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative John, yes, that is exactly what happens. They fill out a form, lay out the details, pretty much in line with what is laid out in Representative Cornish's bill. And then that authority is granted to those limited few. And again, the system has a tracking mechanism so we can see exactly who was in the system, how long, and what they accessed.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Chief Schnell. So in other words, at any time administration can look and see basically have an audit trail, who's accessing it, what's the purpose for this accessing, so besides the yearly audits, you can do random checks to make sure that the system is using properly as well?
Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, exactly. We can conduct routine internal audits to ensure compliance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. So what I would suggest here is this is going to have to continue to be worked on before it hits the Public Safety Committee. And I think this is something that is doable. And what I would suggest is moving forward with the amendment, moving it on to Public Safety. I know that Representative Hillstrom, if you want to be a part of those discussions as we discuss this area of the bill, you're certainly welcome to be a part of that. And but with that, folks, I think that we should move it along. And we're not running out of time, but it's getting close. And this is a sticky wicket, as we've already found out with this subject matter. So any other member questions on Representative Lesh?
Sure, thank you. I'd like to especially commend Representative Cornish in this effort as well, and coming forward and being willing to talk. For the past couple months, Representative Cornish had kind of expressed his desire to want to strike a deal on this, and cautioning that we not dig in. However, remember that the culture of this bill has over the course of 2 years been fundamentally just digging in. So the DE1 amendment was a step forward. I think it was an effort in good faith, and that had to come from law enforcement. That effort had to come from law enforcement, because if it was offered by the other side, we would not be where we're at right now. Okay. So the effort that was made was significant. I think you yourself, Representative Scott, made considerable concessions as well in the language off of your DE3 amendment. I myself have some heartburn, as reflected by Mr. Neumeister, in taking it down, not only just keeping it within the hands of law enforcement itself. I wanted a judge to take a look at this data that you're holding on innocent people, but under this compromise, you're not gonna. And also, it's a low, as Mr. Neumeister pointed out, reasonable suspicion standard. I convinced myself to go with that for a couple reasons. Number one, that is the standard that is currently in place for eyes on license plates. If you see a license plate that is registered to a registered owner that is revoked, you have reasonable suspicion to stop. It's a low standard. It's true. This is license plate reader data for which you would have the same. Now, granted, it's a whole bunch of people, okay? It's tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of images, okay? So a lot more than just eyes on. However, under the terms of the agreement, police need the same reasonable suspicion to look at any one individual of those images. So I think it strikes a balance that I'm not wholly satisfied with, but which I think is, a good journey on the part of yourself and Representative Cornish.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And I would just add that I fundamentally haven't changed my view of what I think about holding information like this on innocent people. But this is a place, the legislature is a place where we compromise and we work on things and we negotiate and we come up with hopefully better products. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, so one of the challenges for me, of course, is, I care about this issue as well. I've been working on it for years, have even been on the conference committee previously when agreements have not been reached. And words really matter. And when the first time I see the amendment is right before the committee starts, I don't have the ability to say on line 5.22, there's a paragraph that talks about the maintaining of a database of where these fixed or stationary automatic license plate readers are, and that it's going to be posted on a website. And then the only time it's not going to be public is if law enforcement determines a location for security purpose. It shouldn't be. So I just think that these words really matter, and when you're going to start talking about public safety and whether or not the information should be public, if you tell everybody where they are, they're not going to go by there. For example, we have an airport, a major metropolitan airport. We have the Mall of America, which folks have been making the news lately. These words really matter, and this really is the committee that these things should be debated in. And so I appreciate all the work that's been done during the interim from this morning to this evening. I appreciate that folks are starting to move and that compromise is potential this session. I think that's great. But I really think that these words really matter, and folks who are debating these issues rely on this committee to do its work. And so, Madam Chair, I'm not going to offer the DE3 amendment. I respect that you're working on the DE4, but I think the DE4 needs a lot of work. And I think there are specific provisions in this amendment that most of the folks that are on this committee haven't had a chance to look at and no one understands. And I think the fact that you're going to disclose any affixed or stationary automatic license plate readers ensures you're not going to have any.
Representative Hellstrom, you read the DE3 from this morning. That's the exact same language as in the DE3, and we discussed it this afternoon. So I understand your concerns, but it's not new language.
And I didn't like it in the DE3 either.
Okay, and we did discuss this as well, and Mr. Freeman indicated that he'd have to take this back and he'd have to get approval from everybody. So far, the only person it looks like he's been able to catch up with is Chief Schnell. So, you have my commitment. You know, I'm not going to just drop the ball on this stuff. We're moving forward. Are you on the Public Safety Committee?
I am, Madam Chair.
Yeah. So if there are fixes in between there and you don't like them, make the changes. It'll get sent back here, and we'll take it up again. You have my word on that.
Sure.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Zerwas.
And I think you're spot on in that. Between now and when this gets to public safety, and then if it has to come back here, I think we're on it. But I think we are starting to see movement from both sides. There's some language in here, and I agree with Representative Hillstrom. I have a concern around that type of inventory, and quite frankly, I'm not sold on the retention time either. I think when you have a delay in a reporting of a crime, that pretty soon, what seems like a long time, 30 days, very quickly, time runs out. But I think between now and public safety, and then if substantial changes are made and it's sent back here, I think as long as the bill is moving forward, I know that will keep everyone's feet to the fire and keep people willing to compromise and willing to work on this. At least that's our hope.
Any other member comments? With that, renew my motion.
Madam Chair. Procedurally, then, so if we're going to go make changes in public safety, it comes back here to review those changes, then we'll send it back to public safety again to review the changes in public safety. Well, we should. Those civil law changes obviously could make an impact in the public safety realm.
Representative Schoen, it would only go back to public safety then if it affected public safety. So if we made changes about data retention or anything like that, it wouldn't go back to them. But if it's affecting any other area of the bill, then my understanding from House Research staff is that it would.
So I guess I'm with Representative Hillstrom here. If we're making data changes, then it should be done here, not in public safety.
Right. Yeah, that's what I just said, I think.
Well, but my point is,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when someone makes a change to who's going to do the review and who's going to make a determination if there's a substantial noncompliance or a pattern of noncompliance, when those decisions are made, because they're going to have to be made, and I assume they're going to have to be made before they go to public safety, doesn't that automatically bring the bill back here because you just made a change to the data portion? And then doesn't it have to go to public safety? Because I'm going to ask for a fiscal note, of course, so we know who's going to pay for the review, because I want it to be done. If we're going to do the audits, I want somebody to do the review, so I want to make sure somebody pays for it. And this isn't a fiscal committee, so it's going to have to go to a fiscal committee, whoever's going to pay for it. So I just foresee that we're going to go back and forth, but do you not see that?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
I'm just going to repeat what I said, that I really do appreciate people's efforts to forge a compromise here.
other folks have the opportunity to be a part of the compromise moving forward. And if that's the will of the committee to work with everyone involved with it, I think it's a good thing. The questions that have been raised can be solved from here on out. So I would ask that we just move this forward and have a conversation.
That's exactly what we're going to do, Representative Lesch. Representative Cornish and I have a good working relationship. We'll continue to work on this bill. We're not going to do anything with it until there's some consensus. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I do have some of the same concerns that Representative Tilstrom has. But I also know that with her on the Public Safety Committee, I'm also on the Public Safety Committee. Representative Schoen is on the Public Safety Committee as well. If it does need to come back here, we'll make sure it comes back here. But with the at least three, maybe four of us on that committee that's also on this committee, we can watch out to make sure things are done properly.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, Representative Zerwas renews his motion to amend House File 222 with the DE4 amendment. All those in favor of the DE4 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
The amendment goes on. Thank you, Representative Zerwas, and thank you, Chief Schnell. Members, I would now like to move.
We have to read it first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Okay, thank you.
I'll renew my motion.
You'll renew your motion to move House File 222 as amended to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Same sign. The bill's on its way. I would like to move reconsideration of the passage of House File 155, which was my bill this morning. All those in favor of reconsidering House File 155 and laying it over back to the Civil Law Committee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 155 is back in the possession of Civil Law. The next bill that we have on the agenda is House File 717. Representative Johnson. Welcome to. Oh, go ahead. And you want to move your bill, Representative Johnson? Yes, your bill will be going to public safety.
I'd take most of this.
All right, thank you. And today, members, we're going to be discussing just the data portions of House File 717. Representative Johnson, go ahead and explain that part of your bill, please.
Madam Chair, I do have two amendments that
all right.
Pretty much technical for this. The first one is the one amendment which conforms the definitions to the federal standards. So, when the manufacturer of buildings stuff goes to federal standards, they understand what it's about.
Discussion on the A1. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. A1 is adopted.
And on the A2 amendment, it deals with the data that's collected by subscribers. Verizon has a program where they collect the data by subscription to some automobiles. Also, OnStar has a program where you actually subscribe to it. This amendment keeps the data as to the contracts that they have with the subscribers.
Okay. Very good. All those in favor of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A2 is adopted. Two-year bill, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, this bill deals with the event data recorder or the black box that's in your car. Currently, the data that it collects, it deals with, originally it started dealing with the passenger airbags, which were being claimed to be going off prematurely, and it started from there and has evolved to a point where it can actually, in some vehicles, tell you if you're stepping on the brake or the gas pedal during a crash. It can deal with the vehicle speed, and in some vehicles, even your turn signal is on, and the capabilities are expanding. A couple years ago, I read a report that NTSB was considering making these boxes GPS capable. And there's a lot of data that can be stored because of the GPS capabilities. And I was thinking to myself, for 12 seconds of a crash, what do you need a GPS for? We know where the crash occurred at. But it's the record six seconds before the crash, 2 seconds during the crash, and 4 seconds after the crash. That's used for accident reconstruction. This bill, the data in there that is in there right now, anybody can go and grab. And as a former narcotics investigator, I was thinking to myself, if a vehicle had GPS, it would be great, because I know that particular vehicle is being used by a person who transports narcotics to different locations for sale or just delivery. And as a narcotics officer, if we don't protect that data or anybody else's data, I could just walk up to it, plug in my little laptop, find out every place that that vehicle has been for who knows how long. In order to put a GPS tracker on a vehicle, you need a search warrant. That's what brought this bill forward, because I'm concerned that the data is owned by the person who owns the vehicle. And there is exceptions in this, so if you bring it to a mechanic, you can tell them, yeah, go ahead and pull up the data, see what's wrong with my motor. But overall, I think with everything that's gone with the LPR, and we just had this nice long discussion about, I think I want to be proactive in getting and protecting this data before it can be used.
Thank you. Member questions? Any public testimony? Excuse me, Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I was just speaking with Majority Leader Pepin on this, because 9 years ago, she introduced a bill like this. There's a lot of opposition to it. So it's to see how time has flied, how important information is. And so I thank Representative Johnson for doing a bill similar to this. But I do have some questions. Mm-hmm. And it's more on the mechanics of the bill. If you look at 215 to 217, it says the data can be retrieved by a peace officer pursuant to a warrant or a court order. In my experience of working on these issues, there's a difference between court order and a warrant. So I think that's very important to be clear. So there's not choices, because sometimes, as part of the debate with the Stingray deal last year and familial DNA that has been here historically, you know, people are given choices and the higher protection is not there, because a court order could be all of a sudden relevant to an investigation rather than a probable cause standard. The other one on line 2.32, that's more of a civil thing. I think that the number 3 applies to if you're looking for it for civil. Then you go on page 3, lines 3-9, again, talking about a warrant, and if that's the emphasis to do a search warrant, somehow it should be connected appropriately, very clearly, at least for the law enforcement entities, that they have to get a search warrant for these kinds of things. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a good bill, good positive bill, thank you. And so I think that's an important item to be clarified.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Representative Johnson, any response to that, or just?
I would be glad to look at that, and even with Mr. Neumeister's assistance, to make sure we get the proper clarification.
Sounds good. Any other member questions? People in the public wanting to testify? Seeing none, Representative Johnson renews his motion to move House File 717 as amended to the committee, be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It's adopted, or it's moving on to public safety. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam.
Okay. Representative Zerwa, Safe at Home, House File 654. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move House File 654, and then I have A1.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and explain your A1.
This is the first step in some negotiating language with some of the interested parties. There will be an additional amendment in public safety that will represent some peace in the valley language with some of the criminal defense or the public defenders. So we'll have that language ready. Public safety is not ready as of yet, but we've made a lot of progress in a day and a half.
All righty. And it looks like you have a testifier with you?
Yep. And I'll hand it over to the testifier and then I'll wrap up.
All right. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Kana Roth and I'm the Deputy Secretary of State. We want to thank Representative Zillas for bringing this bill forward tonight. As you might be aware, Safe at Home is an address confidentiality program administered by the Office of the Secretary of State. The program was created in 2006 by then Secretary Kiffmeyer to protect victims of stalking, domestic violence, sexual assault, and others who fear for their safety. Minnesota is one of over 30 states with similar programs. Minnesota's Safe at Home program currently serves almost 1,900 individuals, representing over 750 households, and a little over half of those participants are children. The program works by giving participants a legal substitute address in the form of a post office box to use in place of their physical address. This address can be used whenever an address is required. First class mail sent to the substitute address is forwarded to the participant's physical address by the Office of the Secretary of State. All participants designate the Secretary of State as their agent for legal service of process. This means that although a participant's physical address is confidential, their phone number is not confidential and it is always possible to legally serve a participant. Under current Minnesota law, there are three circumstances where a participant's physical address can be disclosed, and that is to law enforcement, by participant consent, and by court order. However, there's currently no additional guidance in law for a court to follow when considering requiring a Safe at Home participant to disclose his or her address. Because there is no guidance, sometimes inconsistent standards are used in the court. In one instance, the court ordered disclosure of an assault victim to her assailant. While the Court of Appeals overturned the district court order, this case made it clear that additional guidance was needed in statute, and this is what this bill seeks to do. In short, this legislation provides a framework for a court to use when determining whether to order disclosure and ensures uniformity across the state when a court weighs whether to require disclosure of a Safe at Home participant's address.
Maybe this would be a good time to go ahead and pass the amendment, Representative Zerwas.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas renews his motion to pass the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 has the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be. Representative Zerwas, is there another testifier, or what's the next course of action here?
We may have help.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hugdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. Thank you, Representative Zerwas, for authoring this bill. And I see that Mr. Black is here, so I can certainly have him walk through the bill. I would just add that Legal Aid, as many of you know, represents victims of violence and including participants in the Safe at Home program. And we actually wrote one of the two amicus briefs to the Court of Appeals in the case that was referenced by Ms. Kana Ross. So we're very supportive of the bill and happy to answer any questions. But I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Black.
Okay. Mr. Black, you're up next. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bert Black. I am the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State, and I've been the legal advisor since January of 2003. I was privileged to work on the original enactment of the Chapter 5B and the Safe at Home program. And the bill actually has, there are two sections, but really the guts of it are in Section 1, which has three parts. The first part is the first paragraph and the parentheticals, which state the default position, which is that if a program participant has, if the program participant information is protected under Chapter 5B, which is a safe at home chapter, that their actual address, is not going to be compelled during discovery or during a court proceeding unless there is, number one, reasonable belief that the address is needed to obtain information without which you can't proceed, or there is no other practical way of obtaining the information or evidence. So that's the default position. The second portion is the sort of the what I call the due process hearing or standard, where there has to be an opportunity for the program participant to come and present information as to why that actual address should not be disclosed, and the court has to consider a balance, which courts do all the time, a balance of whether the interest in disclosure to the investigation or prosecution is outweighed by the potential harm to the safety of the program participant. And program participants go into the program because, in many cases, they're being pursued perhaps obsessively by an individual with whom they have a past history. So this is a very important balance. Finally, in Section 1, the final portion, last couple of paragraphs, the disclosure, it limits the disclosure that can occur. The disclosure is only to be, it's to be narrow, it's to be no wider than absolutely necessary for the process. Again, the judge can determine that. And then finally, other information can be the subject of a protective order by the judge in the proceeding. Again, all this in service of the safety of the program participant. And then finally, on the at the very end of the Section 2 language in Chapter 13, this section of Chapter 13, of course, is the section that where the court must make a balance between disclosure and protection. And this is really simply a cross-reference to the first section, 5B.11, as proposed, in order that the courts may be aware of that, the existence of that section, and apply the standards that are in Section 1. And that's the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Any questions from members? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill for or against? Seeing none, and you didn't have any other testimony?
Mayor, I'll just renew my motion to refer House Bill 654 to public safety, I think is where we're off to.
As amended.
As amended, and just so everyone knows, the public defenders have some concern with this language, and we'll have an amendment. That's why they're not here tonight, because they are comfy with our compromise language. So when we see it in public, if you want an amendment, that everyone's not really on.
Okay, very good. All those in favor of referring House File 654 to the Committee on Public Safety, all those in favor of re-referring House File 654 as amended to Public Safety, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. And it looks like you guys will stay at the table.
I will stay at the table.
And we have House File 1524.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1524 to be passed in order. This one's under public safety.
Yes, yes.
Can you refer to public safety on this?
Thank you.
Can I do mine after you?
Okay, Representative Lesh has an amendment. It wasn't posted online, and we don't think we had it by the necessary time, but the chair is willing to waive the 24-hour rule because
we didn't have it in our actual possession. But yes, we can wait on that amendment until the testimony is over. That's
okay,
your
thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Go ahead, Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 1524 fixes in future street calculation on judgments that really just doesn't make sense in today's financial landscape. Up until the change in 2009, interest rates accrued on judgments at the one-year treasury bill rate with a floor of 4%. In 2009, the legislature dramatically raised that interest rate on judgments to 10%. Now, I don't know anywhere you could possibly get 10%, especially in today's market. Members, in 2009, legal aid advocated for an exception of that 10% interest for judgments under $50,000. The argument was that folks with small judgments against them likely couldn't afford a 10% interest rate, and that exception was granted. In 2010, then, local units of government came to the legislature and said, this is that 10% interest rate is way too onerous for local units of government, and cities and counties and townships shouldn't have to pay that 10% prejudgment award, and that exception was granted. Earlier this session, Representative Mahoney was in our committee asking for the former interest rate calculation in family law matters. The argument there from Representative Mahoney was that 10% interest is too high and it's really out of touch with today's economy. The committee passed that bill and it's currently on the House floor. So I think obviously the time for doing one-off carve-outs has kind of come and gone. We should be done making exceptions. And it's time to go back to a market rate calculation, but have a floor of 4%. And we have a few testifiers here that are ready to present and then answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Mr. Johnson, please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I am here this evening, particularly on behalf of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. You will remember we had handed out at the last hearing a roster of the 64,400-some employer members of that organization. Also, at the hearing tonight, we have two other Minnesota for Lawsuit Reform board members, Mike Hickey of the National Federation of Independent Business, and then Doug Braw, who is with DART Transit. So just to know that the breadth of support for the bill within the broad-based business community in Minnesota, Representative Zerwas has given the history on the bill. Just a few key comments. And you have, in front of you was handed out a comparison of states, but just to emphasize, Madam Chair and committee members, I was here when this was passed. The move to 10% was passed in a budget bill. The year that it was passed, it was in a public safety budget bill in 2009, and the comment was that we need to put a higher dollar rate aid to get in more in sync with what other states were doing. This deals with the time value of money on judgments. We all agree there's a time value of money on judgments, and so we're not disagreeing with that, pre-judgment, post-judgment, but what we're doing in Minnesota today is unfair. It is unfair to the private sector. Governmental units in Minnesota came back the year after the increase, and as Representative Zerwas described, said this is costing us too much money. 10% is costing us too much money, and so we need a lower rate. And so the legislature responded and lowered it to the law, which is reads a one-year T-bill rate not to go below 1%. So the statute has built into it a market-sensitive index. I looked up the one-year T-bill rate, and I think everyone probably wouldn't be surprised if you go back to 2009 and then look at that every year. Since then, including to today, you know, 0.37, 0.29, 0.12, 0.16, 0.13, 0.21. So that is the interest rate environment, and as Representative Zerwas said, we have a law that's guaranteeing 10% on money on these judgments. So it's unfair to the private sector. This legislature has acted for governmental units and is acting on a current basis. For other areas of the law where it's been deemed too large a number, the handout, so the committee members know, in terms of states, and we just pulled this and were able to pull the information together today. In the last 2 years, so this chart, in the last 2 years, 25 states in this country have lowered their interest rate, 25. So there were states that were lower than us at 10, and they have lowered their rate further. The point of the matter is America, throughout this country, and legislatures are recognizing that it is simply unfair to build into the system exceptionally high rates that are out of tune with the marketplace. So the trend is clear. 25 states have dropped it, and this is, you know, this is not just in, it's a lot of states have dropped it. Washington has dropped their rates. So if you look at the mix, it's quite a mix of states in terms of their politics, if that's what we're interested in looking at. But again, legislature are recognizing that let's tune up the law. We're supportive of the 4% interest rate is well above market interest rate. So we're keeping, if there's reasons to incent a settlement, if there's reasons to influence behavior so that there's not undue delays, we think that the 4% rate that government has been operating under in this state since 2010 ought to apply to the private sector. I'll end, Madam Chair, I do want to comment that in the bill, there is an exception in the bill on page 3 of lines 3.20 to 3.21, and I do want to comment on that. It specifically deals with the area of lawsuits against insurance companies. If in that year then that was passed, I was involved in our industry negotiated an agreement with then Chief Author Representative Joe Atkins in the passage of 608.0811. So this bill is not trying to undo that negotiated settlement that came out of a very long legislative debate on a significant piece of legislation that ultimately ended up with that particular rate. So we're leaving that intact because that was a negotiated settlement, and I have had no discussions with Representative Adams about changing that number. So, Madam Chair, in conclusion, we think this is it's a fairness bill for the private employers in Minnesota. It's needed to be done because the law is unfair how it's worded today, and that number is simply too high. Let's join the rest of this large number of states around the country that are recognizing that having a double-digit pre- and post-judgment interest rate simply not the way to find that aspect of their civil justice system, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I think we'll go through the testifiers first and then have questions from the members. Who's the next testifier?
Said up front that we've just consolidated, and Mr. Ross here, if there's other questions that come up, Mr. Hickey is here, but then we'll conclude.
All right, very good. I think Mr. Carlson is here. He'd like to say a few words, and then we'll open it up to the members. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and probably next to the Labor Day school start, I probably testified on this bill more than maybe any other, so this one is a perennial issue.
You testified on the Labor Day school start? What do trial lawyers have to do with that?
Well, some of you know I have multiple clients, and I represent resort owners on that issue. But Madam Chair, members, I probably agree with Representative Johnson that this has been an issue that's been addressed in other states. It's page number 22 in the ALEC Tort Reform Boot Camp lower judgment interest rates, and we'll be getting to more of them, I'm sure, this session, but this one happens to be on page 22, and I think that we really are misunderstanding what the purpose of pre- and post-judgment interest really is all about. And what this is about is compensating someone who's been injured by someone else's negligence for the loss of use of their money. It is not a savings rate. It's a borrowing rate. And when you look at right now, when you have been deprived of your money, you can't work, you've got medical bills that are unpaid, you're not paying interest out at the T-bill rate, which, by the way, is at the lowest rate in the country because of the economic failure of the largest insurance company in the world, AIG, in 2008. That's why we have the interest rate that we have right now. But if you look at bankrate.com and find out what is the average credit card interest rate, that's what businesses are charging you when you don't pay your bills. and what you're going to have to pay when those are unpaid. The average fixed rate right now is 13%. The average variable rate on a credit card is 15.9%. That's what post-judgment interest does. It compensates you for the loss of use of your money. There are three components to post-judgment. That's number one. Number two is to promote prompt payment. You know, insurance companies right now settle claims promptly, and that's what the purpose of this interest rate is. And not only do they settle promptly, they've had a dramatic decrease in the amount of appeals to the Court of Appeals, many of which we believe were frivolous. In 2009, before this law was passed, there were 695 civil appeals to our Court of Appeals. In 2014, there were 513 appeals. 27% decrease in non-meritorious appeals, because right now your constituents are getting paid, and they're not getting 10% over a long period of time. They're getting paid promptly, and that's what the law is intended to do. And as it relates to frivolous appeals, the third reason, you need to know why the law was changed. They changed it because of the frivolous appeals. And what happens when insurance companies are able to make more money on the market than what they pay in interest? There is an incentive to delay and promote litigation. You know, in the Insurance Journal yesterday, State Farm reported an underwriting loss for 2014 and an operating profit. That happened because the rate of return on their investments far exceeded what they collected in premium. They are not making 1%, 2%, and 3%, which we get when we put money in the bank. They're making a significantly higher amount on their money in the market, so much so that they can oversee, they can offset operating losses with what they're making in the market. Yet, for one of your constituents who is owed money, and these are not frivolous matters, these are judgments, these are people who have been adjudicated to have caused you the harm, we are now saying that they have an incentive to keep their money and make it in the market and not pay your constituents. I think that that is just wrong. And Madam Chair and members, there are some problems with the bill as well. And I'd like to first draw your attention to Section 2. This is the first time that I'm aware of where a party can pray to the court in a post-judgment motion to not only set the interest rate at what they feel it should be, but they can seek redress from the court to pay no interest rate at all. That is on page 3, 3.33 and 3.35. When we worked on this issue with the courts, one thing that they did not want to do is calculate every single judgment. They want a fixed rate that people know what it is, so that court administration doesn't now have to go in and calculate the interest rate on every single judgment. This not only puts the burden on the court of having an additional court hearing on every single matter where interest is involved, and they will make those motions. It's in their economic interest to make those motions. Court administration is now going to have to recalculate every single judgment. I suggest when this is in public safety, the courts need to come in and talk about the additional burden that this will be on them just mechanically from having to do this. And lastly, Madam Chair and members, I can understand why the business community supports this. It doesn't apply to them. It doesn't apply to them. When you look at 60A0811, something I was involved in and passed at the same time this rate was adopted by the legislature, when businesses are involved in litigation, statutorily they are entitled to 10% interest. So what you're doing is saying that for my consumers, for my people who have been injured in an accident, nobody wants to get injured by a drunk driver, nobody wants to be injured in this way, but we're going to treat our business litigants at a 10% interest rate, and only your consumers will, and your constituents will now be charged a lower percentage rate of interest, far lower than what they've had to pay out on the bills that are overdue, and I just think that is patently unfair. This law has worked. I can also, if anyone's interested, tell you what the issue was with local units of government, of which they don't have a judgment problem. What they had was a problem with property tax appeals that can take a significant amount of time, and that is why they came to us and said, can we apply the 4% interest to property tax appeals? It wasn't because of injury judgments or they owed people additional money for money that has been unpaid. It was a different set of circumstances, and that's why it was changed for local units of government. It had to do with property tax appeals, not the kinds of cases that we're talking about here. So, Madam Chair and members, I appreciate you at least thinking of these issues, because this is really only benefits the insurance companies and does nothing for your constituents. That's our concern, and we would appreciate you to at least consider those as this bill moves through the through the process. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lesh, did you want to move your amendment at this time?
I do, Madam Chair. I move the A15 amendments.
And can you tell us a little bit about the amendment?
If I could have Mr. Carlson explain it, Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, as I mentioned, 68081 does not, 0811 does not apply to the insurance disputes that everyday consumers have. And it didn't need to apply to them, because the interest rate was the same. Representative Lesh's amendment just would close that loop and say, if I have that dispute, just like a business with a policyholder, I would be entitled to the judgment interest rate that any other business or policyholder would be entitled to. We think that's fair and provides some balance, but to say it only applies to business and doesn't apply to consumer policy claims, we think is unfair.
Thank you. Does anybody wish to testify in favor or against the amendment? Mr. Johnson.
Well, Madam Chair, there was a lot there that I know you don't want to rehash here from the other perspective. There is a different perspective on much, and most of what Mr. Carlson said. But on the amendment and on that section, it would gut the bill up, because the description of the current law in that particular subdivision is only benefiting business, and that the business is not affected by the bill. I have to say that's just flat wrong. It does affect liability suits. Liability suits are covered by liability policies that businesses pay premiums for, and the prejudgment interest rate applies. 608.0811 is a narrower class. Adding the word insurance contracts negates the whole bill and pulls under the very liability policies and the type of lawsuits that are involved with consumers and would negate the reason for the bill. So I would urge a no vote on the amendment. The section, probably not for tonight to go through, is a narrower class of lawsuits, and primarily the law that was passed that year, it was really sought by some of Minnesota's giant business corporations who are fighting with insurance companies. And it was the resolution of that fight that saw passage of 608.0811. So this is not an equity issue. This is an issue that rips out the rest of the bill and subjects it, keeps it to the 10%. I think anyway. So that's what the amendment does. I would urge a no vote on the amendment.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson. So just state clearly what is the 1-year T-bill rate currently?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I had the sheet of paper that I had those jotted down. They're all less than 1% since 2009.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson.
Representative Lesh.
What are your clients making in interest annually? I mean, Mr. Carlson just cited the fact that I think it was either Farmers or State Farm, some farm, is actually making profit off of its investments despite an operating loss. So what are your clients making in investment income?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't have annual statements with me tonight. They're publicly available. I can surely get for you any company that you'd like to know. If you want State Farm, is that's the one. But I think, so I don't have the numbers here tonight because I don't have company annual statements. Every licensed insurance company selling in Minnesota, Representative Lesh, is required to file an annual statement. Probably more importantly, as Chairman Hoppe not here, could validate the following that I'm going to tell you. Insurance company investments are tightly regulated by the state of Minnesota. So I think the notion that insurers are what out and dumping a lot of money in the stock market, or if there's some notion of that, is not true. If you looked at any licensed insurance company's financial statements, and again, they're filed annually with our regulator, Commissioner Rothman, to validate or verify anything that I'm saying right now, and I believe he would, including giving you the investment return. Most of those investments, Representative Lesh, are in government bonds, insurance companies, and they are in government bonds because state law narrowly prescribes where insurance companies can put their money. So I could get for you the rates of return, if you will, on any company's investments as they're regulated by state. I don't have them here tonight, and I'd be happy to pick up any annual statement, bring it in, show you the numbers, and you can find out exactly what they are. And I would tell you this, they're a lot less than most other business corporations in this state, and they should be, because the state deems insurance companies and their solvency a top priority as a regulated industry, and the monies need to be there. So their rates of return are, I don't have them here, we can get them, are considerably lower than most other sectors of the economy by design under state law.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, is it fair to say that no matter how low those returns are, they exceed the one-year T-bill rate?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I surely hope so. Yeah, I think that's probably true, that though that bonds make more than 0.37 and 0.21 and 0.29 and 0.12.
Thank you. And Madam Chair and Mr. Johnson, how do you account for the drop in lawsuits to the tune of 27% of appeals between 2009 and 2014 after we pass this?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't have any comment on the drop of lawsuits. I suspect there are a lot of factors that enter into the equation of what's going on with civil litigation, and I think attributing a drop to a prejudgment interest rate law or a change, obviously the opinions are what they are, and I suspect their opinion has a lot more involved to it than that. I don't have any comment today as to why that's the case. I find it interesting, and I disagree that this is somehow attributable or should be related to credit card interest rates. I don't believe that's the history of prejudgment, post-judgment statutes. It's market rates, not credit card rates, but that's a different opinion on that.
Thanks. Madam Chair, and thank you for that, Mr. Johnson. I don't have any other questions for you, but I do find it remarkable that a lot of times when business will come in, they will cite the impact that this has on either consumer prices or the prices that we consumers pay for, whether it's insurance contracts or anything else, based on the laws we make here. But I find it ironic that somehow the drop in frivolous appeals is not directly attributable to the law we passed to curb that in 2009. It strikes me as kind of cherry-picking policy. But, Madam Chair, I think this is important. If you are making that much interest money in the market because you have a huge pool of money to invest to the tune of billions of dollars, and then you have to pay south of 4% or whatever the rate's at in order to continue an appeal process, you are actually incented to delay. It is a good business decision to delay. And your stockholders, to whom you are accountable for your quarterly returns, would expect you to make the smart business decision. So, Madam Chair, I would ask for a roll call on the A15 amendment, and I ask members to support.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Applebaum.
Well, I just have a question for Mr. Johnson. you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
And that's, you know, why shouldn't consumers be entitled to the same rights as businesses when it comes to the interest earned on money owed to them?
Mr. Johnson?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, what I commented is that because that specific statute is a narrower class of lawsuits, if a 3M were to sue a liability insurer, the actual insurer, that's a narrower class of litigation as opposed to, and so that's what that statute is intended to address. The overwhelming share of liability suits that we're talking about here tonight are a business being sued, and a business has a liability policy. Those policies are all subject to the 10% pre- and post-judgment interest rate. So I'm describing, so I believe that's a distinction, and that's why. So the point is that business is interested, and the gentleman who is coming up here can address that. As a major Minnesota corporation who doesn't buy insurance, they self-insure their liability. Perhaps that would be helpful to have the committee hear the perspective of someone who's not buying the coverage, and they're finding the pre- and post-judgment interest state relevant to them.
Okay. Welcome to the, we'll have that next testifier come up and introduce himself. Welcome to the committee, and go ahead and state your name for the record and share with us what you came for.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Graw. I'm an attorney with Dart Transit Company. We're a medium-sized trucking company based in Eagan. And a couple of points. First of all, my understanding of the 60A is that, for example, we have sued customers and customers have sued us. The 10% interest does not apply to that, or it does apply to that. So we are faced with that issue if we're suing. It has nothing to do with insurance. A subrogation claim, for example, that companies might bring against each other. And then also, conversely, as Mr. Johnson pointed out, we're self-insured. This is our money. It's not the insurance company's money. And we have faced, I've talked with some attorneys who are more offensive than us as defensive, who have explained to me that their opening offer on all settlement negotiations is full judgment plus 10%. They don't offer full judgment, they offer full judgment plus 10%, because that's what the law provides. That's what we're faced with, that's what we're negotiating against.
Thank you. Representative Applebaum.
Well, you know, notwithstanding what some parties may negotiate, what we're voting on would say that state law precludes anything but really the lowest possible interest rate that can be awarded. And I just don't understand, and maybe you can explain to me, why we should encourage companies to delay paying debts to damaged parties in lawsuits.
Mr. Graw.
Madam Chair, we're not delaying payments to parties. We promptly resolve our claims. We have our own claims administrators. We handle them. The pre- and post-judgment interest comes in, frankly speaking, when we're dealing with a party that we feel unreasonable. We're in an industry facing, for example, a few weeks ago, one motor vehicle accident with one truck. So there's only two cars involved. The judgment against the trucking company was $145 million. For one death. We have no idea what to do with that. That's we're out of business. That happens to my client, we're out of business. We're done.
Mr. Applebaum, do you think that's reasonable?
That's why you get insurance, right?
You know,
you
$145 million.
Representative Scott, I haven't sat on this committee as long as some, but in my judgment, that's why responsible business owners purchase insurance. And so, you know, I don't think anecdotal stories should dictate our decisions on really important laws that impact all Minnesotans. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I think this interest rate and frivolous lawsuits affects all of us in some way. We're all paying higher costs for goods and services because of it. Any other member questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just one follow-up. So that was a... that was a claim that was being made. That was not a a verdict in the judgment, correct? I mean, I want to make sure I understood what you were saying.
Mr. Graw.
Madam Chair, that was a verdict.
That was a verdict, okay.
$45 million, and no trucking company insures to the tune of $145 million.
Okay, and I guess that was something that was issued by, I mean, there was a court that issued the verdict and all. I mean, because I guess what I'm trying to understand in this, with this bill is it seems like we're talking about situations where the court process has gone through and there's been a verdict that's been awarded, right? And then the question is simply, what happens between that and the judgment, and when, as I guess I find really persuasive, the point that that during that period of time, one person's money that they are entitled to is being held by somebody else. There's essentially a loan that has occurred during that time. Is that, does that fit your conception of kind of describing what we're looking at here in this law?
Mr. Groth.
Madam Chair, that is a fair representation. We're not paying that kind of interest rate on our loans, and we're not receiving that kind of interest rate on our investments. We're an industry that receives, typically speaking, a 1% to 3% return on our business. So anything we're paying 10% is far away our eating our profits.
Representative Zerwas.
Hey, Madam Chair, I think the other part of it is the prejudgment course, where a 10% prejudgment interest rate in some instances can encourage individuals to drag out a process, compelling someone to come to the table for maybe a less favorable negotiation, just simply by dragging out the process, knowing that they're accruing this ongoing 10%.
Right. Thank you. Representative Pinto, you still have the floor. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess, but again, what I'm trying to figure out is we're talking about a period of time when this kicks in, and I understand that there's negotiations based on this, but negotiations still have to be based in some kind of reality. So in the end, there's some sort of verdict that is determined. There's eventually a judgment that's awarded. And I guess during that time, one party's money is essentially being used by the other. And I understand, different industries might do different things, but I looked on bankrate.com just now and looked up personal loan rates. And so this is, there's mortgage rates, of course, but then that's a different sort of thing. There's credit cards, we talked about that, but just a personal loan. And just right now, Lending Club has got a rate of 9.9%, Freedom Plus, 8.9%, Vouch, 9.9%, Avant Credit, 19%, TCF Bank, 12.8%, Prosper.com, 9.49%, and Think Mutual, 5.99%. And so just, I guess the way I'm just looking at this is one party's money and other parties, we have to have a rule that applies to a lot of things. And in that way, it seems like in order to choose some sort of rate to encourage just moving this along, that it seems pretty reasonable to me. So thank you.
Any member comments from here? Any closing comments? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just got a quick question for Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Carlson. Go ahead, Representative Grunhagen.
See, do you know if there's been an increase in lawsuits and appeals where the interest rate has been lowered in these other states? Because obviously a lot of states have lowered their interest rates. And it'd be interesting to know if that has resulted in an increase in the appeals and litigation.
Mr. Carlson, you have an answer for that?
I don't off the top of my head, Madam Chair, but it's to the extent it's a knowable answer, I will endeavor to find that out for you, Representative, because I think there's a corollary, and I do think that as it relates to the amendment, I think Mr. Johnson just hit the nail on the head in that what the 10% interest applies when big businesses are fighting their insurance companies, and that's when it applies. But we don't want to apply that, or the Lesch Amendment would apply that when a consumer has an insurance contract, when the balance of power is the worst. This isn't 3M fighting for what they're entitled to. This is your neighbor trying to fight the insurance company to get what they're entitled to, and we don't want to apply it in those types of insurance situations. And it didn't need to be changed when they passed that law in 2009 because we changed the overall interest rate to 10% at that time as well.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other testimony we just had from a trucking firm is that when there is a settlement on a judgment, they're automatically adding 10% to the judgment. Now, the judgment should cover the damages, in my opinion. And again, there's a delay there. I understand they should have some interest. But if they're automatically adding 10%, do you think that's happening in the state like we just had testimony to?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I won't directly dispute the witness, but that's not been the case that has been presented to me about interest. And what you're entitled to is interest 30 days after judgment. If they pay the judgment within 30 days when they've been adjudicated to owe, they don't owe any post-judgment interest. I mean, they don't automatically owe interest. Oh, here's my judgment. You owe me 10% additional. That's just not how, that's not how the law works, but that's not how the judgment interest works either. You have a period of time to pay that judgment. After that period of time, that's when the interest accrues.
Representative Hager.
Yeah, just a final comment. I still think we had caps on liability.
We could avoid a lot of these problems.
Madam Chair, members, I do want to find out about the $145 million judgment. That's one that I read most of them that are here across the country, and I have not been aware of that one, but I want to find out what happened in that case.
Thank you.
Because that's one that I haven't been made aware of.
Okay, we're going to go. Oh, Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, if you could find out, one of the reasons we passed the bill and went to the higher interest rate was because insurance companies in particular were not paying.
Correct.
And so do we have a record of if payment has improved or not? Because if you have to pay interest, you're more incentivized to pay your bills. And I would like to know if the record actually resulted in people actually getting paid sooner. Because ultimately, if you're entitled to a judgment and you're entitled to money, we want our citizens to get paid the money they're entitled to.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, I can speak anecdotally that the change in 2009 has changed behavior. I fear giving you anecdotal evidence because I don't like that if it gets used on me. So the easiest thing that I can tell you is that one of the complaints we had is what we considered an unbelievable number of frivolous appeals. And I can show you that they're down. They're just absolutely, according to the Supreme Court, they are down, and they're down dramatically. I even used the 513 number from 2014. And prior to that, it was even lower. It was in the 400s. So from a high point of 700 down, it's had a dramatic impact.
And I don't know that it's, as Mr. Johnson said, I don't know that we can scientifically say that the two are related.
I'm sure. This is a have your cake and eat it too thing. I mean, I spared Mr. Johnson this time from asking him, if this passes, are our insurance rates going to go down? Okay? Because I can give you the answer. He's going to say no. No. No, I'm not going to promise that the insurance rates are going to go. And yet at the same time, every time we have something that states our folks want to be paid on time, it's going to increase your costs, and your costs are going to go up. Have your cake, eat it too. This is actually a bill. We've got the number. It's not anecdotal. I mean, I don't hear anecdotal. Someone has to pay. Someone had a judgment from a jury. A jury decided that they owed $140 million for a single death. Apparently, that's bad. I think there was one industrial accident I heard of where the judgment went up to $40 billion. The cost went up to $40 billion. It still won't cover the total cost. It was the Deepwater Horizon. Before that, the biggest judgment was Exxon Valdez, $5 billion, which was never paid, by the way. Never paid, because it got locked up in litigation, ongoing frivolous litigation. And so frivolous lawsuits are going down, members, okay? That's not anecdotal. I mean, lawsuits, appeals are down. That is a fact. So I ask members to please vote yes on the amendment. It's reasonable. You want to protect big businesses instead of your neighbor that has what's common to them, their judgment, then vote no. But if you want to protect your neighbors, vote yes on the A-15 amendment.
A roll call has been requested on the A-15 amendment, and the staff will take the roll.
Chair Scott.
No.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Applebaum.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Representative Hellstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hoppe.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Schoen.
Yep.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative Zeroas.
Nay.
With the vote of 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion failed.
Motion has failed to the bill. Further questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the insurance companies.
All right. Go ahead, Representative Elster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at this article that was referenced in the insurance journal about profits, and clearly insurance companies have the ability to pay when a judgment has been ordered. I don't care what the insurance rate is if insurance companies actually pay. So would you be opposed to an amendment in the next committee that would say that if the insurance company doesn't pay the judgment within 60 days, they are no longer licensed to sell insurance in Minnesota until the judgment is paid?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, no.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, again, one of the things that we need to make sure is that the people who have rightfully won a judgment in a court of law actually get their money. We have a couple of ways to do that. We can incentivize the companies to pay, or we can penalize them if they don't pay. I believe that this will actually incentivize them not to pay. So hopefully, Representative Zerwas, maybe we can work together to come up with a suspension of their license to sell insurance in Minnesota if you want to go forward with reducing the insurance rate, the interest rate.
Representative Zerwas, do you have a response?
I look forward to working with Representative Hellstrom on a number of things. Maybe not that thing, but a number of things. And that means, members, just a reminder that a big part of this and what nobody really wanted to talk about apparently was the pre-order, the pre-interest on, and what that looks like from the time that you get a letter that says, hey, I'm going to sue you, versus how long can we draw it out, and then now that it's done, and I want my 10% for all of that pre-adjudication time. And so I think that's the part that is really difficult, and it becomes difficult for the companies to understand this, especially if we heard testimony here today from individuals that self-insure, which, quite honestly, the idea that if you self-insure, you're not a responsible business owner just clearly isn't factually accurate. I think there's a large number of entities that self-insure, and so I think a lot of cities self-insure, a lot of school districts self-insure, so I don't know if you think a lot of cities and school districts are not being responsible by electing that option. But this impacts a lot of areas and a lot of people. It's a good bill. Vote yes.
With that, members...
Madam Chair, ask for roll call.
Sure. Roll call has been requested. Staff will take the roll call. Let me renew the motion. Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 1524 be re-referred to the Committee on Crime Prevention and Public Safety.
Madam Chair, one more comment I forgot to address.
Representative Zerwas.
Frankly, in reference to Mr. Carlson's testimony, and I'm good friends with Mr. Carlson, but just so everyone's clear, I'm not a member of ALEC. I've never been to the Fun Convention, and to my knowledge, this is a good business-friendly bill to help Minnesota fall in line with other states all across the nation. Not it wasn't exactly the Toll Coke brother that brought me this bill. I can't remember which one. It's not that. And so I want to be very clear about that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Staff will take the roll.
Chair Scott.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Applebaum.
No.
Representative Grunhagen.
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Hoppe.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Lesh.
Nay.
Representative Lohmer.
Yes.
Representative Pinto.
Nay.
Representative Schoen.
No.
Representative Vogel.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
Aye.
I have a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays. The motion passes.
Thank you, folks. Members, we are set again on Thursday morning and then again Thursday evening. Wednesday. I'm sorry. My bad. Tomorrow evening and then again Thursday morning. So thanks for bearing with us.